Hidden Gems, Episode 58, Christmas Stocking Stuffers. Welcome to Hidden Gems, a board game podcast where we review unusual, forgotten, and underappreciated board games. We're your hosts. My name is Chris.
I'm Jason.
I'm Bill.
And this is Cameron. Thanks for listening to your...
Thanks for listening to your show.
Thank you for listening to your show.
This is your show. We do it for you.
It's a gift.
And I've been on... This is my third episode in a row.
Oh, we're just going. I thought you were going to redo it. Let's just roll. I love it. Hidden Gems unedited.
Yeah, that's right.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
That's right. Merry Christmas, guys.
This is great.
Ho, ho, ho.
I always feel like when I'm coming to the recording night for this episode that it's like the podcast host Christmas party.
Yeah.
You know, we got our cocktails. I brought us a special gift for us for a bourbon for us to enjoy tonight.
Is there karaoke?
Yeah, I'm crushed. I forgot my Santa hat and my suspenders.
I was fully expecting you to roll in here with your suspenders at least.
Yeah,
and I'm very disappointed, Bill.
We got table presents.
We do have table presents.
Strong table presents.
Coined by Cameron last year. We have gifts on the table here that we're going to be exchanging a little bit, which I'm always excited about.
Oh, yeah.
My first present of the year.
Oh, yeah, same.
Have y'all gotten anything yet? You were just in Pennsylvania.
I was in Pennsylvania. So my family's up there in the Hershey-Lancaster area. And we got back at like 11 o'clock last night after driving for like 12 hours in the rain.
Oh, my God.
But you exchanged gifts.
We did. So my gifts these days are mostly like get me a gift card to Home Depot or something so I can do something on my house. But I did ask for one, and that was Ticket to Ride Legacy.
Oh, yes. So
I'm pretty excited to play that with the kids.
That's fun.
Oh, interesting.
And or Chris, if he wants to play after the fact.
Well, I did mention it in one of our backstage episodes. We did a Gen Con, or was it a preview? We did a preview show, and Ticket to Ride Legacy was one of my top five anticipated games from that show. So I'm really interested to hear your experience with it, because I'm just kind of okay with Ticket to Ride. It's good.
Yeah.
But the idea of a legacy version of Ticket to Ride is really cool. To me, I think. I think it's a great idea.
I have difficulty imagining what that looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Ticket to Ride is, I mean, it's okay. I play it with my kids, but I'm not going to seek it out to play it on a normal game night. But something about opening little boxes with things in them makes it seem like it could be more interesting. Didn't work for Pandemic for me, so we'll see if this one's better.
That's too bad.
But, yeah.
So we had a white elephant or dirty Santa, I guess, depending on where you are, at work. And that was kind of fun, but I brought Take It Easy there, and we played with eight people there who'd never played it before. So we played it three times, one to get used to it, and then the other two for other prizes. So people won stuff, and they ended up liking it. And then that was one of the ones I put in as Dirty Santa.
Nice.
And I'm feeling pretty happy because that was the last gift that was stolen that day.
That is the key indicator of the quality gift.
Exactly.
Do you play where it can only be stolen so many times?
Yeah, twice.
Okay. Twice. Yeah.
We tried that once recently without that rule, and it turned into chaos.
It's a chaos. Oh, you have to limit it.
You have to. Yeah. Well, what was pretty funny was Ellen, who's the one that ended up with it, was really cagey about what she was pretending like she wanted. She was like, oh, there's some lottery tickets there. And she's like, I really want the lottery tickets. And I think she just kind of threw the other people off a little bit.
That's funny.
She's the one that took it.
Yeah.
I think, Bill, Take It Easy might be your second most well-traveled game apart from Hanabi.
Oh, it could be.
Which is your number one and probably permanently most well-traveled game.
That's probably true.
It's on a boat going to Antarctica.
Well, and I think it travels up and goes to Alaska and it goes to Iceland. So that boat goes everywhere.
And Bill and I played it on the plane to Origins a few years ago.
We did. So,
special memory.
That Hanabi has gotten everywhere.
It's got some legs.
It's funny because I was at Eagle Griffin Games. Isn't that where this thing is? Is that where you get Hanabi or somewhere else? Well, I thought
I think it's a different
Take boat. It Easy is Eagle Griffin.
Because
I had to replace my... I've replaced my Ticket Easy three times now, but
we had four copies at one point.
Yeah, I did have like four, but I got down to one and the package just showed up, and I did get the follow-up version, Take It Higher, I think.
Oh yeah. I've not played, but I've heard it.
I can't imagine that it will be better than the other, but I just figured it was like $8 or something.
Do they have like a third one, Live Free or Die Easy?
It's got to be an Eagles lyric.
I was going to say. That's right.
So, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it was fun. 30 Santas are always fun. I ended up with gloves, by the way, that my wife brought. So, for women. Gloves? Yes. So apparently, I didn't play the game well. Yes, exactly. They were Eddie Bauer.
Isotoner like, gloves.
So, yeah, like bidding games and Dirty Santa, I'm terrible at them.
Oh, awesome.
Well, do you guys want to share some stuff you've been up to, I guess? That's what we do in the banter portion of the show.
Absolutely.
Why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, start us.
Okay. Yeah, I got a fun one. And in fact, it's real fresh for me because I've been super busy. I think at this point,
as usual,
folks that usually listen to the show know that I'm an entrepreneur. I've started a business. Now I've got a YouTube channel. So I'm going like 14 directions all at one time, in addition to having a brand new baby and a 2-year-old. So I'm pretty busy. But actually, we sat down last night. We watched Home Alone with Owen, my 2-year-old, for the first time. And he had a great time watching it right up until the point where people started getting, you know, an iron smashed on their face and stuff like that. And he got scared when Marv slips on the water and falls down the steps. So we let him go to bed. But we had a blast. It was like just nice to like all sit on the couch and not think about work for a little while and watch a movie together as a family. Kind of for the first time, because Owen, we don't really let him watch a lot of TV. But yes, we did that. But the one I wanted to talk about is I went ahead and watched this movie because I kept seeing it pop up at the little splash screen on Netflix. I had not seen the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. And we hadn't really talked about it as a group, I guess, because maybe all of us hadn't seen it. But
I think Jason did.
Yeah, I might have brought it up at one point. We hadn't all seen it at that point.
Right.
So, yeah.
I mean, it is like nostalgia explosion. Just about everything in the movie is some type of throwback to fans of Nintendo in general and Mario in particular. And I just loved it. So the very beginning of the movie starts out with Mario and Luigi's plumber commercial. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the second that it gets over, they're like talking to each other about, like, what did you think of it? You know, did you think the Italian accents were overdone? And this guy turns around from standing right next to them from an arcade machine that is Jumpman. Okay, the arcade box is Jumpman. And the guy playing the Jumpman machine is Jumpman. And it's the voice of the original Mario.
No way.
Voice acting.
Luigi.
Yes. He's like, it's great. Woohoo. And you're like, oh my gosh. That is so much like dense nostalgia, like packed into the first moment of the film.
Yeah.
And it was just really, really fun.
Yeah. They did a really good job of like making, I think I said this last time, but of making a story which makes absolutely no sense on the surface into something that like kind of tied everything together in a unique way. And made the story actually interesting, right?
Right. It's so. Like, why? Because you're always asking, well, maybe you're not, but I've always asked the question, like, why is Mario the plumber, like, fighting monsters and jumping on toads that are walking around, or turtles that are walking around?
What does Princess Peach see in a plumber? Right. Was it the butt crack that got her? Or was it?
But yeah, so yeah, it pulls him from this Italian plumber in Brooklyn into the world in the way that it does. I thought it was well done.
Considering how much crap Chris Pratt got for not doing a Mario voice for him, it actually worked really well. I mean, like if he had done like the over-the-top Italian accent the whole time, it would just be like ridiculous.
Yeah. It is that sort of thing. Like, how long would you actually want to listen to that?
Right.
But I actually thought that he did a good job pulling off like he clearly had like a New Yorker voice. It didn't sound like his normal accent.
Mm-hmm. I need to watch this.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
No.
Oh, man. No. I'm glad I haven't like given anything away. There's so much. You're going to enjoy it.
Much as I love Nintendo.
There's so much just fun stuff. And they integrate all the stuff with the power-ups and the relationship with Mario and the Mushroom Kingdom and Kong Kingdom and all of that stuff.
I need to check it out. I mean, as I've said on the show before, my wife accuses me of being fiercely nostalgic. And when I was a kid, I got the Nintendo Power magazine.
Right.
I had like the books with all the lore in them.
Did you see the original Super Mario movie, the live action?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And from the 80s?
Yeah. Swing your arms from side to side. Come on and do the Mario.
Oh, yeah. Totally have seen it. Yeah. Cartoon. I used to watch the cartoon. Yeah. Did y'all watch the Super Mario Brothers cartoon?
For sure.
The real guys. The
animated.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it was animated, but they're also the live action.
They would jump into the pipes and it would go into the animated thing. Yeah.
I kind of immediately wrote off the movie just because I still had memories of the original live action one in my head. And I was like, no. But they did it well.
I had bad dreams when I was a kid of the Goombas because it freaked me out so much that they had tiny heads.
Well, Bowser is kind of freaky in the old movies too. Yeah. So much nostalgia.
So anyway, yeah, the Mario movie.
Awesome.
Good stuff.
I feel like I'm over contributing to this. Yeah, I cannot relate to any of that. I mean, I played it with my kids, but I just did not grow up with that. Yeah. Which is funny.
You had you were like the old Apple computer games. Oh, yeah. Right?
I was Dr. J versus Larry Bird on the Apple II. Saturday morning cartoons. I had the Jackson 5 and the Osmond Brothers and the Harlem Globetrotters.
Oh, yeah.
Did you watch those?
I mean,
before we move on from movies, I'll throw one out there. It's completely opposite vein of Super Mario Brothers, but we don't actually watch that many movies either. And Jenny and I finally the other day sat down and watched a movie because I had seen it pop up a couple places called The Holdovers. Anybody seen this? So it's.
No.
It's a Christmas movie. It's Paul Giamatti as like an old grumpy like boarding school professor.
Paul Giamatti playing a grumpy character. Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah, you know. But he's an old, are they professors? I don't know, at boarding schools. Teacher at a boarding school in New England. And he gets stuck being the guy who has to stay at the school over the Christmas holiday to stick around with all the kids who don't have anywhere else to go. And it's like this rich, preppy boarding school. And so he's kind of like cynical towards all the kids and everything. But then he gets stuck with this one kid there the whole time. And they like hang out and they get to know each other. And it's a sappy movie, but it's a comedy.
Yeah.
A dramedy. You
a dramedy, uh-huh. Yep.
I don't know. It just has a really good soundtrack. Peaceful and nice. And so recommended. Could be a good just like new chill classic Christmas movie, you know?
Nice.
So I had to rent it on Prime. Okay. So I don't really know that it's on a service.
Sure.
I mean, I talked about Pennsylvania already. That's probably my banter.
Okay.
Let's save it for next episode.
I got something real quick. Can I go next?
Yeah, go for it, Bill.
So from my daughter's boyfriend, he just sent me this link that they're live streaming the volcanoes that are erupting in Iceland.
Right? You talked about this last episode.
I did.
Is it happening now?
It's happening now. Exactly.
Yeah, that's wild.
Pass that around.
No freaking way. It's like a lava field.
This is a big, long strip. It's pretty wild that that's happening now, and another piece of evidence that we just timed the strip absolutely perfect.
Right.
Yeah.
Have hit this and do that, which is pretty cool.
Well, it's like you said last time, Iceland is enlarging itself again, it seems.
Exactly. So. Along this line right here.
Right, yeah. But there's nothing there's no like villages or cities.
Oh, that's very close to the airport.
Is it really?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Holy crap.
It's probably... In miles,
I mean, isn't everything very close to the airport?
Yeah.
So, well, right. Yeah.
And they were talking about they've had like 2,000 earthquakes in the last 24 hours or something like that in the area. I mean, there's just lots and lots of them. But to bring this back around to Christmas, by the way, so I think I said this last time too, the Icelanders love Christmas, right? And they don't have Thanksgiving, so they have no qualms about starting Christmas like the day after Halloween. Because it's already dark. And while we were there, the Christmas beer came out. So I brought a Christmas beer to share.
That's why I had the cups.
Is it Einstock?
What's that?
Is it Einstock?
We'll see what it is. It's a Viking Jobbelag.
Ah, nice, Bill.
Anyway,
how's that pronounced, Bill?
I have no Jobbelag. How's that? Is that better? Jobbelag. Yeah.
I will say if we have any folks from Iceland that knows how to pronounce this, just. Record yourself and leave it on the Discord.
J O with the circumflex on it. L A B J with circumflex over R. So
I would go with Jolabjor.
Jolabjor is what I just said.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jolabjor with a little more trill, whatever.
That's fun, Bill. Thanks for sharing. I love these holiday episodes. Everybody's sharing and
great.
You're bringing stuff. Yeah. One other thing I'm super excited about is Chris is getting his family. An Oculus 3.
I am indeed.
Kidding,
it's time, Bill.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. So
to my kids,
right.
Bryce, Kale, please turn this off.
Surprise.
This is why you should listen to your dad's podcast.
Yeah, they totally don't, which is why I'm not at all worried about you saying this right now.
Right. So there's a couple games I just wanted to mention that I feel like you just got to get. But one of them I shared with you today, and I'll just talk about it because it's super cheap. What is the software discount warehouse place that's called Humble Bundle? Something like
no
that.
No idea.
I have no idea.
I'll look it up if it's important, but there's like 10 different VR games that are all being sold for $18.
Saw that.
And one of them's called Battle Group, and it was designed by one designer, which is pretty amazing to me, but it's like Battlestar Galactica. So you're standing on this giant cruise ship, and you're looking out the window, and you're sent on all these missions, and you have a console in front of you that lets you set your missiles and your defense systems and all these different things while you're steering the ships, and the power allocations to your shields while you get attacked or attack somebody else. And then you build out your fleet and you outfit them through the ship designs or whatever. He's done a really good job. And then you can jump from ship to ship. I think you'd like it. I mean, it's one of those things that is really immersive. The second one is Iron Wolf, which is the submarine thing, four-player submarine. So everybody has their own station. And
Right.
That, I mean, I think that would be fun. And the final one is, I think you really love, is Iron Man.
Oh, well, yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's number two on my list. But I will tell you, my number one most anticipated is Half-Life Alyx.
It's,
You sold me on it when you described it in our when we talked about our top video games.
Is that the one that you showed
games.
Us a preview of at the game retreat like a couple years ago?
I can't remember. Maybe. I mean,
you would like set it up and you were just like, just walk around. Like that, it's so beautiful. It's sort of so well rendered that like, it's cool to just like look at everything.
And the very first thing scene, you start in the balcony and it's like you're looking at a War of the Worlds thing. Cause it has these tripod alien vessels that are dragging power cables across lines. So everything just feels like it has believable and it has a purpose or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not really paying attention to you. And then you go inside and you can look out to that same scene you're looking out over the balcony, and it's this dirty window and just the opacity of the window, the dirtiness of it. And then there's these grease pencils and you can draw on the window like a little map or smiley faces. Whatever, just the attention to detail for them to have all that.
Yeah.
It's over the top. But anyway, I'm excited for it. You
guys can't wait, man.
Adventure.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. I'll pour these while you go, Chris. Nice.
Oh, thanks, am man. I next? All right. So I also have a video game to talk about, and I'm excited about this one because this one was really good. I know I say that they're all good, but believe it or not.
How much better is it than the last five that you talked
about? I actually play a lot more games than I talk about on here on the show, including graphic novels that I read. Like, I don't talk about everything that I read and play. I only talk about the ones that are good, okay? And this one was good, and it was surprisingly good. I wasn't sure what to expect going into this game because the premise is really bizarre, and man, it just freaking worked, and I'm excited to talk about it. So the name of the game is called Yoku's Island Express. Do you know what this is?
I've heard of this. I haven't played it.
Do you know what it's about?
I don't remember.
Okay. So it is a Metroidvania, like Hollow Knight, pinball game.
What?
Yes. I am telling you, it's crazy, and it totally works. Okay, so you're a dung beetle. Okay.
Okay.
So, you know, you're rolling your ball around.
Okay.
But it's not a dung ball. It's like a metal ball, right?
Okay.
You're rolling this metal ball around. And you're on this island. It's self-contained. You'll explore the whole island by the time the game is over.
Mm-hmm.
And you're the new postman. Is the theme.
Okay.
So you're supposed to be delivering mail, but you kind of get sucked into this bigger story of like the island spirits are being attacked by something. There's a storyline to it. But basically the idea is you're rolling this ball around and all throughout the island are flippers.
Okay.
And so you will launch yourself via your ball that you're attached to two different areas in the game. And it's precise. Like the pinball mechanics are on point. So much so that, like, there are certain areas that you won't access or see unless you hit the paddle right. It will launch you through a tunnel or into a chute that will take you to a different part of the island that you will not otherwise reach unless you hit it right. You have to hit it right. And there are certain paddles that are locked. And as you collect, I think it's fruit or something, you can spend it to unlock those paddles, and that will send you to different parts of the island that you couldn't otherwise reach before.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the Metroidvania aspect of the backtracking and going back to places you couldn't get to before.
You know that there's a locked paddle somewhere, so you go back to it and you go hit it. Okay.
Yeah, it'll like lock you into these certain areas where you're fighting a boss, or you have to get through that section where you're flipping the paddles to hit certain targets to where you can get out, basically.
Okay.
It's crazy. It doesn't sound like it should work, and it's one of the best games I've played this year.
Wow.
For sure. It is so cool.
It's an like old a three game. Quarter.
It's older, right?
It is older, yeah. Like three or four years, maybe.
What's your view of yourself? Is it like three-quarter?
No, it's side-scrolling.
Side-scrolling?
Like Hollow Knight.
Like a typical Metroidvania.
Yeah,
right?
Like a Metroidvania.
Okay.
You're moving. Yeah. You can move up and down.
You move up and down, across. Okay. But like I said, as the flippers flip, you'll like launch. You'll like go to different parts of the island.
Okay.
And there's also a puzzle-solving element to this game.
Ooh.
I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil it, but just to kind of give you an idea, you can change the appearance of your ball.
Okay.
And based upon the appearance of your ball may grant you access to different areas that you have to figure out. That's just one example.
Okay.
Basically, I'm just trying to sell the game to you that it's really, really good.
That's so awesome.
It's not a super hard game unless you try to 100% it, which I did because I was just fascinated by it. This is one of the games I actually fully 100%ed it because I was just so fascinated with it.
Okay.
Yoku's Island Express.
I just looked it up. It's 80% off on the Switch store right now. It's $3.99.
Dude, buy it now.
Man. I will go get it. I don't know when I'll play it. But it's I'll go get it. I liked Hollow Knight enough that I think Metroidvanias are kind of my thing.
Dude, it is so good, man.
$3.99, I can afford that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Pick it up. It is totally worth it. Like I said, it surprised the heck out of me, honestly, when I played it, and I really enjoyed it.
I'll probably keep it until the next time that I fly up on a plane somewhere, which will be when my kids are like 2 years older
than
they are
now.
You
could beat it in 10 hours. Okay. If you 100%ed it, maybe like 15. But, I mean, it's not a super long game. But
it's not like Hollow Knight.
The level design, it just blew me away. When I was playing through it, I was like, man, who thought of this?
Yeah.
It's just so
cool.
It
sounds
cool. It is cool.
Awesome.
Highly recommended.
Do you like pinball?
I do like pinball. I'm sucky at it. Every time I play pinball, I always question how there are people that can actually consistently play it well. Because I feel like the ball always falls exactly in the middle between my paddles.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do people play this and that not happen to them?
Right.
Consistent, unless you're kind of cheating a little bit, which I think is kind of part of it, right?
Going on tilt.
The good players kind of will tilt it slightly without getting the tilt error or whatever.
Right.
So a great VR is Star Wars Pinball. It's hysterical.
Oh,
it's,
a VR for every situation.
But just the animated things that are on the pinball. I mean, you don't think it would add that much, but on the pinball table itself and just the things that you can do when it's, you know, virtual versus, you know, and still follow the laws of
Bill's
physics.
Just going to live his life in VR.
Yeah. That's right.
Chris,
he's ready for player one.
Do you remember we went to the pinball museum in Asheville my bachelor weekend?
Dude, it's one of my favorite places in Asheville.
Well, ironically, a lot of us like ended up mostly just playing like video games instead of pinball. Because
they have an awesome video game area too. If you're ever in Asheville,
just go arcade games.
This is where I grew up. Go to the Asheville Pinball Museum. It is incredible. You can buy a bracelet and you can
like
play all day.
You just like stay inside, go to every different machine. You don't need quarters. You just play whatever you want.
They have pinball machines in the front. And then in the back, there are like three different rooms that have all the old retro arcade cabinets. Robotron, Donkey Kong, Pac-Man.
Defender, Joust.
Centipede, everything. Dig Dug. Mm-hmm. It's all back there. It's awesome.
Fun.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Sweet. Well, like normal, we've got a cocktail. A Christmas cocktail.
We do.
This one's very Christmassy.
Mine's gone already. We talked to
mine is also gone already.
Yeah, I had fun making this one. This was a little more elaborate than I usually do. So Talia actually sent me this recipe. She wanted me to make it.
Thanks, Talia.
Yeah, thank you, Talia, for the recommendation. It's my wife. So this is the Grinchmas margarita.
I feel that.
I was wondering.
It was a very Grinchy color.
It's a very Grinchy color. So it's green. So you'll remember, Cameron, when we did our Lord of the Rings episode way back.
Yeah.
Like episode 10 or 11, I did a cocktail called Sting, and it was greenish. Yep.
Midori?
Because it's got Midori in it. Okay. That's exactly right. Okay. As does this one. Okay. So whenever you want to make a drink green, you use Midori, which is like a melon liqueur, basically.
Nice.
So this one is 1.5 ounces tequila, 3/4 ounce Midori, 1 ounce of pineapple juice, 3/4 ounce lime juice, and then 1/2 ounce of orange liqueur. So you shake it, and then you strain it into a cup, and then you take a little bit of maple syrup, and you kind of run the cup one side of it in there, and then you dip it in coconut shavings, and that kind of makes the beard.
Oh, okay.
Right? And then you put a couple of mint sprigs or mint leaves in the glass for, I guess, just more green, make it more Grinchy, and then you put a maraschino cherry in there as well. So
nice.
Yeah.
It's very festive.
It's a fun one.
Great presentation.
Yes, thank you, Bill.
Great table presence.
And speaking of table presence.
What a great segue, Bill.
Well done, Bill.
It's time, everybody.
I feel like you should lead us into this because you're the one that coined this, and I thought it was just brilliant.
So, obviously, it's fun to give gifts to one another, and it's a board game podcast. Therefore, table presents.
But I'm.
Can I drum roll on the table now?
Nope. All right.
Well, before we get into the gifts, I'll let you lead us through, Cameron. But I did want to do one thing really fast. I wasn't going to tell you I was going to do this, but you know, Christmas, Thanksgiving is obviously a time of being thankful, and I'm thankful for you guys. Aww. Thankful for this podcast. It's just fun to do. We're still going strong. I guess almost it's 3 years
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. January.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm just thankful to be a part of it. And I'm thankful for the listeners. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to read something. I read it, actually, to Jason and Bill. You've not heard of this, Cameron.
Okay.
But every so often, we'll read something that the listeners will write to us. We appreciate every comment, everything that our listeners say. But there's every so often where somebody will write something that just kind of puts the wind in the sails. Mm. You know what I mean? And kind of reminds us why we're doing this and why we're thankful for the people that do follow us. It means a lot. So this was written by Gary May, also known as Rye Otter on BGG. Just want to read this really quick. So on December 5th, he said, "Thanks, guys, for the podcast. I found you late, but have been listening through the back catalog. Spotify tells me I'm a top 4% fan in 2023. I gave you a shout out recently on my LinkedIn. If interested, hashtag games in school should get you there. I wanted to say thank you for Take It Easy in the designer spotlight in Eagle Griffin Games in episode 30. I now own 2 copies, which are being used in schools and pupil referral units in and around Dover, Kent, United Kingdom. I introduced another couple of pupils today in alternative curriculum provision. We played 3 games back-to-back at their request. Fun was had. The pupils remarked how this kind of problem solving wasn't really taught in school, and it really should be. I'm confident that gathering around a table to play games has something of real value to offer a post-COVID, hyper-digitalized youth culture. At least that's certainly the case here in the UK. You are now contributing to that, at least in my little field over here. In other news, Recto Verso, which is Laboka, went on order this weekend for use in a project supporting pupils with verbal communication challenges. Best wishes for 2024.
Wow.
Love that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. That's
is that amazing. Not awesome?
Impacting the learning of the youth.
Across the pond.
That's amazing. Seriously.
Man, when I get things like that, mm-hmm. I just could keep doing this.
That's you cool. know,
it just reminds me why we're doing it. And I love it, man.
That's so cool.
Very cool. Thanks for sharing.
Our fun is making school better for some kids.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
And it was just so ironic that Bill was just talking about Take It Easy. We talk about that one a lot.
We do. Mm-hmm.
That game is just like a special game, I think.
Yeah.
Especially for us.
Right. I mean, if you're going into a group who doesn't play games and it needs to be scalable, I mean, I don't
know.
Really
like accessible. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it can play 99 people.
Right.
So
the way that you figured it out with multiple copies, right? Mm-hmm. It just works.
Yeah.
Cool. I think the other folks that I would love to give a shout out to is our patrons on Patreon. For sure. This show has been effortless at this point because we have people that we know are going to be listening every episode, and they're going to be tuning into the Backstage Podcast, which we have a lot of fun making because there are no restrictions on that. They don't have to be, you know, unusual, forgotten, or underappreciated board games that we talk about on that one. We just talk about whatever we want, and people still love it and listen to it and give us their feedback. And they give us their money, and they fund the hosting fees of the podcast and our website and the boring stuff that like costs money to do, but that you can't have a podcast without.
Yep.
And so thanks to our patrons.
Yeah, it's appreciated. We're actually in the green now.
That's exactly
we weren't
right.
for a long time.
That's right.
We paid for things out of our pocket for a long time.
Yeah.
It's nice to not have to do that anymore.
Exactly. So, and if that's a community that you want to join, this isn't a sales pitch, but like it is a really interesting community to be a part of. Yeah. And there's an exclusive podcast that we only make available to folks who are subscribers to Patreon. So you could head over there and join in. We'd love to have you.
Yeah. What are we talking about today on Backstage, Cameron?
We are going to talk about
Christmas stuff.
Christmas stuff. Just Christmas stuff.
Random musings about Christmas.
We talked about
traditions,
that, and I still forgot what we were talking
gifts,
about.
Just whatever.
How it contributed to our hobby.
Yeah. How it contributed to
Hidden
the gaming
Gems Backstage.
Hobby.
The true
a
meaning
board game
of,
podcast you know. Where Cameron doesn't know what we're talking about.
We just fly by the seat of our pants. That'd be great.
Well, as we wrap up another year, I guess since everybody's giving the shout outs.
Wrap you know, up. I, got it. See what you did there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just say, you know, shout out to our wives as well.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I feel like yours especially
yeah.
being out here with a new baby. But I know our families and wives contribute to us being able to have the time to do this. And yeah, so that's, yeah, it's meaningful.
As much as we play. Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Bill, what are you going to add?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. No pressure. Pressure. No. I mean, it is funny. Cameron was talking about coming over here and the feeling you get on the way over. And I will say that as you get older, as being the elder statement in the room, statesman in the room, as Chris likes to say all the time, it's, you know, your groups have a tendency to shrink or go away or whatever. And I'm just feel so blessed to have kind of fallen in with you guys. And it's just so nice to come in here. Even the days when Chris wins, it's still kind
Chris
of okay.
Chris is complaining.
Exactly. But it's just nice to get out and just have the fellowship around the table. And this is just awesome.
Yeah, so, man.
Love it, man. Glad you're with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. All the warm fuzzies and everything out of the way. Let's do some presents.
I want to hear some ripping paper. Let's open some stuff.
All right. Who's going? So the way that we do this is each year, before the Christmas episode recording date, we draw names out of a hat or whatever our weird system was, drawing cards or something this year.
That's right.
We had very little time to pick out gifts.
Exactly. And our goal is to basically, each person gives one gift to one other host.
Yep.
Okay. And so we just do that, and we don't know who's meant to give a gift to the other person except for the person that we gave a gift to. So. Yep. I don't know how we determine who goes first. Should we Schwazi? Yeah.
I'll start. So we'll go clockwise for me, I guess. So good. I will say that this year I drew Jason's name.
All right.
Oh, awesome. Uh-oh.
So Jason, this is your gift.
It's a giant lump of coal.
I am really hoping you don't already have this. And if you do, just pretend like you don't and act excited, and then I'll exchange it later.
Oh, I should say, along with this, while Jason's unwrapping, that we are the qualifications for these gifts are meant to be not necessarily something board game related.
Right, right. Yeah, so it can be board game tangential, but it's not like we're buying Trajan and giving it to each other or something like that. It's usually something a little bit more unique. So,
the Wondery Outdoors. That's always a good start.
It is.
Oh, nice. National Parks. Oh, it's a water park.
Yes.
You cross them off that you do.
Okay, I thought it was a puzzle.
Yeah, so this is a water bottle that has, according to them, very, very tenacious, sticky stickers that as you visit each national park, you actually stick it onto the water bottle.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
It's like a checklist.
So like half of your stickers are going to go on there right now.
Exactly,
huh?
Because it's been the mini. But yeah, it's kind of like a visual way of showing which ones you've been to, which ones you still need to go to, and you can kind of mark it on your bottle there.
That's cool.
That'll be very cool.
We should put a link to this on the show notes or something.
Yeah, for sure.
That. If other people are big national parks people and want to check it out. It looks a really nice bottle. It's white. It's got gold sort of engraving on it. And I guess it's a bunch of stickers that come with it.
Yeah, man, you're welcome.
Excited to put some stickers on there.
I was excited.
Jenny's always giving
me
a hard time because I never drink enough water. So
there you go.
Perfect.
Oh, you get that too? Yeah. I get that a lot. Actually,
you don't throw your stickers away. They're
Casey's a lot more subtle about it. She just brings a bottle of water and sets it down next to me. She's just like, here you go. 20 more ounces.
Yeah, those are cool.
Looks like a 24-ouncer too. Maybe 36.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Perfect.
Merry Christmas, Jason.
Good job.
All right, Cameron. All right.
Good job, Chris.
Who'd you get?
I got Bill.
Oh, baby.
Here you go, Bill.
I'm excited.
Big old present for
Big
you.
Bag. Big
I
bag.
I bet it's a fold-out pool table. Oh, my goodness. It feels heavy. Ooh. Is this a cutting board?
It is a cutting board.
Oh, dude.
And it's got the Hidden Gems logo engraved on it.
Oh,
not
dude.
The HG one, because I know that one's not your favorite. I know you like the big logo.
That's right. People wouldn't know. It's like recessed in here.
The story here is, so this is a white oak, maple, and walnut cutting board.
I'm holding it up to the microphone.
My thought here is that you just got your bar renovated. And so this could be like a dedicated bar. Like you need to cut up.
Got to cut your limes on that. Yeah.
Lemons or whatever.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So, and it's got the HG logo.
It does. I love that. I love the multi-wood here. What's the different kinds of woods?
So the lighter ones are maple, hard maple. And then the darker one is walnut. And the rest of the board is in white oak.
It's got these cool like woods racing stripes all the way across.
Inlays.
That looks good, man.
It's gorgeous. Thank you.
You're welcome, man. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. And now Mine feels like a booger.
Come on, Bill.
So, yeah, I'm feeling the pressure over here, too.
Yeah, exactly. So, Cameron, this is you.
Oh, look, they got each other.
Paired off this time.
That's right.
Yeah, either one's first, I guess. So this is kind of for Eleanor. So, but it's also for the dad thing, because I did get something for Owen at the beginning. I was like kicking myself a little bit for not getting this for Eleanor.
We got a book here, The Paper Bag Princess.
Oh, dude.
So you know that one, Chris?
I don't. That's super cool. I'm guessing it's something cute. You read to your daughters, maybe.
Oh yeah, this is like for raising strong young women. Yeah. The premise of the story is, a dragon comes and burns down the castle, burns everything up, burns off like the clothes and everything. And so the princess puts on a paper bag, but the dragon carries off Prince Ronald. And so the paper bag princess tricks the dragon through various things, like having him fly around the world by bragging on him. Says, "Hey, man, I heard you could do this. Can you do this for me?"
Yeah.
It's like, "Hey, I've heard you could burn down a forest with a single breath. Can you do it?" It's like, "Oh, I'll do it again." Anyway, so she wears out the dragon, and he passes out at the end. I know this is a spoiler.
No, you're totally spoiling the book, right?
But when she gets to the end and she gets Prince Ronald, he's like, "Here's a mess. You smell like soot. You're wearing a paper bag. Come back when you look like a princess." She says back to him, says, "Oh, Ronald, your hair's perfect. You smell nice, but you are a bum." I'm gone, and they didn't get married after all. So
it's very clear to me that you've read this like 250 times. Yeah. Well,
what I love about this is that all of our books right now are about tractors and excavators and all the things that Owen loves, and maybe Nora will love those too, but we don't have any like specifically Nora books.
Oh, there we
go.
So
that's beautiful. Love it. If there's a second gift here.
There is. This one's kind of more for you, but then okay. I'll be quiet.
Man, look at this.
We got a Papatan Shadow Theater.
Oh, dude.
Magic show of light and shadow for the whole family.
So what you do is you take your phone and you turn your flashlight on it. Yeah. And it has a series of stories that you read. And given the fact that you are our voice man here, you kind of create.
You can do that justice.
Oh, yeah. So
your
you can like.
Favorite fairy tales. Little Red Riding Hood, The Lion and the Mouse, Three Little Pigs, The Tortoise and the Hare. This is right in my alley.
That is so cool.
And I figured, I mean, like with foam or whatever, you can make your own. This thing is a shadow puppet theater, by the way. So it has a translucent board in front of it. You shine a light behind it so you can see the shadows in front of it. And so your kids sit out in front of you and you put the shadow puppets behind it. But you could like make a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah.
So you could actually make the paper bag princess. Okay. Read the paper bag princess or other things.
That's cool.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I love that. Man, I have a really, really crappy laser engraver. Your engraving was like the best that machine has ever done.
Oh, it's awesome.
but I bet it would cut through paper bag stuff. I can make my little
characters.
Little templates. Yeah.
Nice.
Fun. Awesome. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Good stuff, Bill.
All right, I guess that leaves me.
Oh my gosh.
The pressure.
Woo!
What do you get the guy who has everything gaming related you could ever imagine?
Dude, I'm excited.
I had to go a little out of the box here.
Okay.
And this is a risk, both of them. But you know, I feel like we like to share discoveries with each other. So.
Oh, book. What's this?
A non-picture book?
Oh. Yeah.
So that this is the risk here. This is a non-picture book.
Okay.
So,
oh my gosh. So look at all these words,
just,
Jason.
Just be warned. The other risk is that I actually haven't read it, but I got myself a copy of it too. And I've heard a lot of like
look at the page layout of this.
Yeah. Yeah, so
this is super.
So the book is House of Leaves.
Yeah.
By Mark Daniel Lewski.
Yep.
So I've heard a lot about this book. It's kind of like a puzzle, but it's like a book. It's like a book inside of a book inside of a book. And I've heard many really good things about it. It's kind of like a horror slash mystery slash like there's just weird stuff going on.
Well, I can see that from the pages. I'm holding up some to the guys and there's
text written in opposite directions.
Yeah, upside down on the same page. And then there are certain pages that just have like pictures on them and like four or five words. And
oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So it almost looks like an escape room in the book, kind of, in a way.
A little bit. Like, I've read the first couple chapters of it, and it's interesting, but you have to push through some certain parts.
Okay.
But like, it's supposedly really interesting. So,
dude, love it.
And I'm reading it too, so we'll see. We'll see how
it's,
it goes.
It's 300 pages, by the way, you guys.
So, it is, so tune in.
We'll talk about it on the podcast.
Tune in on episode 60.
No, no, it looks cool.
67.
But I'll get there. But it technically doesn't have pictures in it, so I apologize in advance.
I love it.
I'm guessing you can't make that an audiobook.
All right.
Yeah, probably not.
One more here.
The second one is this. I know that you like to travel around and go to art museums.
I do.
And so,
I just did it this weekend, actually.
And I know you like the bizarre and the strange. So this is like a, this is a picture book. So I got this one right. Or at least it has pictures in it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I just saw a bizarre and strange.
You did.
Again, I haven't read this one either. But it's a collection of like the weirdest real actual historical paintings and art pieces that are out there.
Oh, wow.
And, like, explains and talks
about it. That guy has a protuberance.
Dude, that is so cool. You were totally right. I do love. So, I don't know if I've ever said this on the podcast before, but, you know, we live fairly close to D.C. and a lot of museums and stuff, and I will go to D.C. by myself for the day because, and this is no slight against them, I get it. There are a lot of people like this, but my family treats museums like a race. Mm. Like, how fast can we get through this museum? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I like to kind of linger, you know, and just, I can spend all day. I read all the placards, try to like learn something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And art museum is one of my favorite. Just kind of seeing people's outside of the box creativity and how people just think. I'm not super artistic, but I appreciate it. Mm. And that's super cool. So yeah, I'm looking forward to going through
that one's way outside the box. So.
Love
it's called the Madman's Gallery.
Edward Brooke Hitching.
Wow, nice. Chris. I learned a dimension about you that I didn't know existed.
That's you didn't know so, I liked museums?
Man, you are an onion.
So. I'm telling you. So I was in Atlanta this weekend. Bryce had a video game convention, DreamHack, in Atlanta. And all day on Saturday, I spent time on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta, which is known as Sweet Auburn. That is called that because in the like 30s and 40s, it was one of the most successful, affluent African-American neighborhoods in the country.
That's where Martin Luther King
is born. That's exactly right. Okay. So I went to his birth home, spent time in the King Center in Atlanta, and just kind of learned about the civil rights movement, things I didn't know, and just eating it up. Love stuff like that.
That's cool.
Yeah. Nice.
Great. Man, what a great round of Christmas gift giving.
Oh, awesome.
Love. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
We're only at 47 minutes already.
Luckily, these games are a little shorter.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
I'll quickly segue us in.
These are stocking stuffer games.
These are stocking stuffer games. So if you've listened to the podcast, you know that we've done Christmas theme in the past, but we've exhausted that.
There are exactly 7 Christmas games.
That's it. It's done. So we had to get a little creative. So I thought, what are some games that we could review that would easily fit in a stocking? Small box game. So that's what we're on.
If you can find them.
If you can get them.
All right, well, let's get into those games.
Let's do it.
Step into the shoes of a secret intelligence agent. The information you possess must not fall into the hands of your enemies, and as you try to decipher their coded messages, they'll try to break the codes of your precious data. Hone your talent for deduction to decipher enemy codes without making the mistake, because your opponents will benefit from your mistakes. All right?
All right. Got that?
Have you got it?
This message for self-destruct and 50.
This message.
Oh, gosh.
You're the only one that can stop it now, aren't you saying?
We're all dependent on you now.
Sensitive information.
Put your colored discs in the right spot.
It's funny how you pick that up from the French on the back of that box.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Fantastic, Cameron. Well done.
Thank you.
All right. Kryptos. Published in 2014 by Cranio Creations and Treffle. At the time of this recording, its BGG ranking is 6,490. Designer of this game is Piotr Silka. And this is his only notable design. All right, brief rule summary for Kryptos. Kryptos is a quick-playing logic deduction game where the players are trying to guess the identity of cards hidden in their opponent's hands. The central component of Kryptos is a deck of cards numbered from 1 up to 48. In addition to a number, the cards in this deck will also be assigned one of four colors: blue, red, green, or yellow. I will say right off the bat, it's important to understand that these suited cards are not in sequence. So in other words, what I mean by that is, like, the blue cards, for example, are not 1 through 12, and then the yellow are like 13 through 24, whatever. It's like blue is like blue 1, blue 5, blue 9, so they skip. And that matters from a deduction standpoint. At the beginning of the game, each player will be dealt 9 cards face down, and then 4 cards will be randomly removed from the game. Each player will take their cards and order them from low to high in their hand. Once ordered, each player will also take a matching color disc for each time they have that color of card in their hand. So, for example, if once I've ordered my cards from low to high, I look at my hand and I have 3 red cards in my hand, I will take 3 red discs and put them in front of me. And that's important because I'm communicating to the table, I have 3 red cards. Now, the people at the table don't know what those values are. Only I do, but they know that I have 3 red cards. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, starting to the right of the start player and moving in a counterclockwise direction, each player will reveal a card in their hand. For example, I might turn my blue 9 around, showing it to the table, and then revealing its position in my hand relative to all the other cards that I am holding in my hand, which again are ordered from low to high. So everybody will do that once, and then it'll come back around to me, and then I will reveal a second card to the table, and everybody will do that. So everybody, once the game starts, will be showing 2 cards to the table that everybody will know. Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple of quick rules about that. You cannot reveal your extreme cards, so your lowest or your highest card. The 2 cards you pick can't be adjacent to each other. And then once the table corporately has revealed 2 of one color, no more of that color can be revealed. So if Jason and I have already revealed yellow cards, Bill and Cameron couldn't reveal yellow anymore, nor could we. That color is kind of off the table for revealing at that point. So once all the cards are revealed, the game begins. So a player's turn in Kryptos is very simple. You will point to a hidden card in an opponent's hand and try to guess its numerical value. If you're correct, you will earn 3 points and your turn ends. If you are incorrect, you can guess again. It's important to understand you can guess the same card, you can guess a different card in that player's hand, or you can guess a different card in an opponent's hand. There are no restrictions there, but you can guess twice. But it will cost you a point to guess twice. So if you got it right, you would only net 2 points instead of the normal 3. After your second guess, you cannot guess anymore. A player is only allowed to make 2 guesses per turn. Again, if a player correctly guesses a card in addition to scoring points, that card is turned around or revealed in that player's hand. Again, importantly, if you're having a hard time kind of understanding what's going on here, maintaining its location relative to the player's other ordered cards. So, for example, let's say Cameron guesses a card in my hand and he's correct. He says, I think that's a blue 15. I turn it around and reveal it. And so let's say I've got like the yellow 8 is revealed too, and there are 2 cards between the yellow 8 and the blue 15. Now everybody at the table knows those 2 cards have to be between 9 and 14, right? It's 2 of those cards. And then you have to figure that out based upon what color discs are in front of me, what's already been guessed, what hasn't been guessed, different pieces of information you kind of garner from the table. Play will continue on in this way until one player has hit 15 points, which triggers the end of the game. At this point, once all players have had an equal number of turns, the player with the highest score wins the game. That's generally how you play Kryptos.
As always, good job, Chris.
Thank you. All right, so interestingly, we've been talking about logic and deductions a little bit on the podcast recently, but mostly more on Backstage. We've played Search for the Lost Species, and we've played Search for Planet X. We talk about awkward guests on the podcast from time to time. We're no stranger to deduction games. And this one is like that. It is a logic and deduction game, but it differs in some ways from those games, right? Particularly being on a smaller scale. But when you heard me going through this game and kind of explaining the rules and knowing that we've played those games recently, was there anything that stuck out to you about Kryptos, how it might be different from those games, or anything that really kind of was noteworthy about it?
Well, it's funny, having listened to you say the rules again, it's much more clear as you hear it multiple times. But the first time you said it to me, I was like, how in the Do you understand? How are you going to figure this out? I mean, I was just like in this kind of, I don't know, lost in the weeds moment. It's like, yeah. You know, there's just no way that I'm going to look at somebody else's hand and be able to pick out any card in this hand with the information I have.
Yeah.
And so
I'm only seeing one quarter of
right. One quarter of my hand. Get it, I have this right. And the other cards are flipped out. But what's funny about this game, as you start getting into it, and for me, it was kind of a slow reveal that there is way more information out there than you fully appreciate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really had this. It's like, this is a horrible game, was my first. Like, I'm like, this is gonna suck. I got to go, man. My wife's calling. I got to get out of here.
Yeah. One of the things that I missed very early on in our first play of this was the reality that, like, when you have these four different colors and then you have all these numbers. If you see a number, you can start to gather like, okay, well, could he have the 9 or whatever based on the number of the color of chips in front of you?
Right.
And so it's like Bill said, like there is a lot more information on the table, but it's a lot to take in early on.
Yeah. For me, when you explained the rules, I was excited because I feel like one of the challenges with Search for the Lost Species, Awkward Guess, all those games is that while the deduction is awesome, explaining those games is tricky.
Yes.
It's hard. And it's hard to get new people excited about a game like that when you're like, well, just let me explain to you these like 17 edge rules. And right. Make sure that you remember every single thing I say because I can't help you with a single thing after we say go because it's all secret information.
Right.
Right. That is daunting for like a player to take on. And so I was excited to see if this was actually a good game because you explained pretty much the whole rule set.
Yeah.
I mean, totally. You didn't leave out much. So, yeah, we'll save thoughts for later, but like I was excited to try out because I really enjoy deduction games like this that are not like, oh, figure out who that person is when they're moving around, like Name of the Rose or what's the other one? The detective one that where you're moving around the houses.
Oh, well, yeah. Heimlich & Co.
Heimlich & Co. Right. Yeah. Like those are deduction too, but it's deduction while you're also trying to do something else. Like I like pure deduction games. And so I was excited to try this one.
You should probably talk about the tableau in the middle because that is important. Because whenever you figure out something, why don't you explain it?
Yeah, so there is a central board. And it, really the only thing it adds is it's just a help to the players at the table. It isn't necessarily like, how do you say this? It's a part of the game, but it's just open to everybody. Basically, it's a bookkeeping method for everybody to see what color every number can be, what colors have been guessed. And again, we can all see that because people have turned around correct guesses in their hand, but it's just nice to be able to look at a central board and be like, okay, all these numbers are off the table. I can see what has not been guessed yet. I can kind of see what's available. And it kind of just helps simplify the deduction without giving you the answer. It just takes away some of the annoying bookkeeping that you would have to
do. Well, but I would say it's more than that.
It's a little bit of analysis paralysis.
Right.
Well, but it also shows you what color is what number. So that you go. So that's super important.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, it gives you information.
Right. Exactly.
I guess what I'm saying is we're not like fighting for position on a board. It's just like a help.
Yeah.
Right. It's an aid to kind of help you.
Registers things. Yeah.
Yeah. Without it, the game would be
nothing more annoying than being like, you make your guess and everyone's like, no, you said it. It's like, wait, I didn't know it had already been guessed.
Yeah, that's already been guessed.
It's already been like revealed. It's like, you don't want to have to deal with that stuff. And that makes for not really.
I mean, heck, Jason did that anyway.
Except for when you're like me and you guess a number that's in your own hand. Because I was just like paying so close attention to Cameron's hand and trying to like deduce what was in his hand. I was like staring at it for like 5 minutes. And then I guessed a number. And I was like, oh, shoot.
But
like,
you also
I have that number.
You can't go back on that because you don't want to reveal that you're holding it.
Right. It's like, oh, I'm holding that. Yeah, I think I agree with everything you guys have said. I think the thing that impressed me the most about this game, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying initially, Bill, is when you first look at the game, you're thinking, how? How am I going to figure all this out? But there are little things that you pick up on as you begin to play the game that are just these little areas of cleverness that are just really satisfying when you make these multi-step deductions of these if-then statements in your head of like, well, if this is this, then this is this, then that means this has to be in his hand. And you'll make those deductions, and it's just really satisfying.
Yeah.
Like, for example, one of the things that I began to really enjoy about the game was there's a little bit of a memory element to it, right? Because if Bill asked Cameron, is this card a 15? Well, that probably means that Bill is not holding a 15, right? So now I have to remember that, right? And so you begin to tuck that information away. And then every now and again, somebody will make a guess and you're like, how in the world did he know that that was the 24? But then you begin to ask yourself, well, what is he holding in his hand that I'm not seeing that made him so confident that that was a 24? And then you begin to go through the thought process of, well, maybe he's holding this and maybe he's holding this and he's not holding this because he asked about this. And then you figure things out.
Or sometimes you guess your own number just to throw everybody off.
Which you could do. I don't think we did that. But and that would be things,
a No, I was saying that's what I did. One of the things I made a mistake. But,
One of the things that helps is this sort of Hanabi-esque, you know, some of the cards are facing you, some of them aren't. And so what that ends up showing you is this like range, right? And so you're looking at this combination of colors that this person has in front of them. And you're looking at, okay, well, you've got a range here from 13 to 21. And I'm like, okay, well, which cards that aren't already revealed, right, that fall into the colors that Chris still has could be between 13 and 21, right? And that can start to answer some questions because it can only be certain cards.
And I remember Bill asked Chris if he had a 17, and he said no, so I can take that off the table.
And then you filter out what I'm holding the 15,
so I know it's not that one.
Right, and then you whittle it down. So, okay, I think that one of these has got to be this or this. And then you, then that's where you make the educated guess, right?
Right.
So it's fascinating because you think, like, I'm not that smart. Like, I'm not going to get there. But if you think about it long enough, you eventually do start picking up on it.
Yeah.
It's a rewarding deduction game where I feel like some of these deduction games they're so broad that you really have to be putting together like a ton of information. I've personally felt really overwhelmed playing Search for the Lost Species and the Planet X game because frankly, like I'm not that good at memory stuff. Ask my wife, my short-term memory is horrific. And I'm probably just not patient enough for really serious deduction. I feel like Chris, you like crush this. Any of those games where you're going around and you have to figure out who's who, Chris always nails every single person, and I'm like, oh, you're making random guesses at the end of the game. So yeah, I think this one rewards you for not necessarily being like that good at memory or deduction.
Yeah, I like that it has that element. Well, it gives you the ability to make good educated guesses
right.
And that's because of those chips. Like if I see that Cameron has three red chips sitting in front of him, still
reasonable guess.
It's like, oh, okay. Well, that I can play the odds and say, well, there's a good chance that this card is red. So based on its position, maybe it's this.
Right.
And I can make a good educated guess based on that information. And even if I'm wrong, it helps to narrow things down. Now, granted, it helps other people too if they're paying attention. But like, I like that it's not just an all or nothing. You don't have to like be able to if then that. All the things in order to be able to make a guess. You have enough information to make good educated guesses too.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, did you find yourself in many places where you weren't guessing something because you felt like you were revealing too much information?
Yeah. So I would say for me, it didn't happen too much because like Jason was saying, I felt like I kind of got in these situations where I had it down to two. So I was like, well, I guess this one, if it's wrong, then I'll guess this one. It's one less point, but you know, I can get it. But there are definitely situations where that arises because I know it happened to you last game because Bill made a guess about number two, which he got right. And then I was thinking, how would he have known that Cameron was holding that two unless he was holding the one? He has to be holding the one, right? So you do worry a little bit about, you know, your guesses, what they tell the table about your hand, right? Because you want to make it hard for your opponents too, right?
Yeah.
And what can happen especially in the ends, you can start a cascade because once you start filling in the ends, I mean, the stuff in the middle is really hard.
It's hard.
It's hard. There's just a lot of variables to that. But when you start chipping away at the sides, and especially if you have, you know, something on that level of the end, it is kind of obvious what's next. So it's funny, when I was playing the game, I kind of knew something. I think it was about Cameron's hand pretty early, but I held on to it for a really long time because it was like, I can't ask it because everybody at the table will know the next thing next and everybody will get three points. Which so it's an interesting point of tension, I guess, in the game because do I get something that is a potentially no pointer or two pointer to protect that? Because somebody else could still get it. They might know it and be able to guess it. So it's interesting. It's an interesting game.
Well, any cons that you guys thought of? I will throw one out briefly, and that is that we played this at three players the first time, and it was not great.
No,
at three, because it felt like pretty much every time it would come to you, you had a pretty good idea of a card. I don't know why that is mathematically.
We never missed.
Yeah, I never.
Well, you missed one time, Bill.
I did.
But otherwise, Jason and I were 100%. Bill had one miss because he got unlucky in guessing a number that had been randomly removed. But pegged it every time.
That's true. It felt like if you had any decent deduction skill or experience, like you could figure something out.
Yeah.
But man, when we changed to four players, it made a huge difference.
It's interesting because I didn't have that experience because I wasn't here the night that you guys did the three player. I only played it at four, and I would have said that it was a fairly challenging
game. Yeah, when we started the four player game, Jason, Bill, and I looked at each other like, whoa, this is way harder. It was instantly harder. I will say also, we played with the variant, and if you pick this game up, you need to play with the variant where you remove four cards from the game randomly. That unknown information that nobody can account for needs to be there. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think the game probably is maybe a little too easy if you're experienced in logic deduction. Play it four players. Play with the variant where you remove four cards. It's a good game.
I had no idea that it was a variant.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had no idea that it was a variant because you do factor it in. I mean, I remember many occasions thinking like, I think that might be the one that's out.
Is that a removed
card? I think that yellow card is out and the Bill is actually holding this one or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to factor that into the mix.
How many does this play? Because it plays more than four, right?
You play up to five. We never did that.
Because I feel like that would make it even more challenging. Because I'm trying to figure out mathematically why it became so much harder. And it's probably because there's a whole nother like scale, right? In a three-player game, there's only three scales. So you're only trying to narrow down a number on three different pegboards. As the number of pegboards increases, it's like, okay, well, the range between the numbers gets wider.
But the distribution of the cards doesn't change. It stays the same, but it's now in different people's hands.
Well, and there are more cards.
And the percentage of known numbers in your hand is less given the distribution. Mm-hmm. Sounds like we're doing a lot of final thoughts.
Yeah.
Anybody want to start?
Bill, kick us off, man. I like it. I think it's a good time.
So, like I said at the beginning, I was kind of daunted when I first started this game. It's like, how am I going to even have a hope of being successful at this? And this is one of those games that, like Chris was saying, as you play and you figure things out, it is super satisfying to like make that level deductions.
And then everybody like oohs and ahs when you like guess the number.
Right.
How in the heck?
Right. Because they don't have that information.
Makes you feel smart.
Right. Exactly. And as you get into the game and you're looking at the colors and the numbers, I mean, there's some, like you're saying, educated guesses. Now, I was looking online, and some people were saying that it's a bit elementary, I guess, maybe if you played a lot. I'm not sure I felt that at this point yet, and it probably maybe is, but I think it's a great game to introduce to people who, you know, maybe don't play a lot of deduction games.
A good entry into the system.
Exactly. Yeah. And to me, it's a great filler as far as game length and or teaching the rules. I mean, it's low complexity. And so for what this game is, I think it is great. It hits it out of the park to me. And so I'm going to give it a 5. So,
nice.
All right. Let's go. Christmas cheer right there. Yeah,
that's right.
Coming out with a 5.
It's Chris's drink, I'm sure.
All right. Is that me?
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe I gave it away at the beginning when I was talking about complex games and the simplicity of this one. I think, Bill, like you nailed it. You kind of nailed my thoughts on this one. I was excited to try a full-on deduction game that wasn't at the level of complexity of Awkward Guess, because the number of times that I've been like, oh man, I have a large group of people who want to play a game, like we should play Awkward Guess, and I'm like, but I don't want to have to explain it to them. Like, nobody's going to understand what I'm talking
about. Especially if they're not used to it.
And they're
going to
be confused, right? I play games with my work folks occasionally, and I've considered it, but every time I'm like, but it's complicated.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't even know if I have all the rules straight in my head, having played it a couple times. And so as good of a game as it is, it doesn't come off the shelf very much for that reason. And so this game, I was excited about it, and it delivered. Is it the most complicated, deep deduction game out there? Of course not, right? But I feel like it hits that niche where I would play this with my kids, right? Mm-hmm. Because it would be a good exercise for them to like learn basic deduction skills, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I gave this one a 5 too. Maybe it's the Christmas cheer going around, but I really enjoyed this one and would be excited to play it some more. Bring it on the weekend.
I was already planning on it. Sure. Yeah, so I'll just come out and say I like this game also. I echo what Bill and Jason have already said, so I won't belabor the point. I'll just reinforce a couple of thoughts that it's not super common to have a logic deduction game filler.
Mm-hmm.
And this one accomplishes that. Most logic deduction games are long and complicated, like Jason said. And I love those games. I love Awkward Guess. Is this game as good as Awkward Guess? No, it is not. Is this a good game, though? Yes, especially for the amount of time it takes to play and how long it takes to explain and just to whip it out real fast and say, hey, let's play a quick game of Kryptos. It works. As long as you play it at four players with the variant, it's really good, and it just has those really satisfying moments of peg that card.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I figure that out, and it feels good, you know? So I think it accomplishes that. I think it's a good game. I'm going to give it a four. I like it.
Nice. All right. Well, glad to hear that that's how all of you felt about it. But no, I'm kidding. This is fantastic. I am terrible at these logic and deduction games. We played Name of the Rose. We played the Heimlich & Co. We've played like several, this handful of deduction games at this point. And every single time, I am just like in dead last and like excruciatingly so. Right. I rarely feel like I don't know why I'm at the table, but I feel like that in some of these games, like especially, I mean, Planet X is just like, I'm not even competitive here. But this game, I felt like I had a shot.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was in it and I was engaged. I was able to reason out certain cards and get some wins, right?
Yep.
I don't think I won, but I didn't care because I was actually
having
fun.
One time.
Yeah. Did I?
Yeah, I think you did.
Maybe. Okay. Can't remember.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
It's a positive reinforcement game for sure.
And right. When you guess a card, it's like, oh, I could do that again. You know?
That felt good.
And you don't have to be like super good at memory or super good at deduction in general to enjoy this one. And I really loved that about this game. And so I think I'm probably going to stick with a four just because generally speaking, deductions are not my forte. But for what it is,
it's one you actually like.
Yeah. Like, I mean, like if you guys are talking about bringing it to the gaming weekend in January, like I'm in, right? Mm. Count me in for that one. I want to play it again. And that's what a four is for us. We don't always go over our scale, but for those who aren't familiar with it, when we talk about a four is like, I like this game. I definitely want to continue to explore it. I want to see if I can get better at it.
Yeah, if people pulled it out, you'd be like,
sign me up. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that's a four for me.
Nice.
So who was the guy that was from the guild that you just read earlier? What was his
name? That I just read from.
Yeah.
Well, that gave us the really nice feels.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean.
Gary May.
Yeah, Gary May. I mean, to me, hey Gary.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're looking for something that's like.
This would be great for kids. Yeah.
Great for kids and building the idea of how to apply logic.
Totally.
And this would, I think they find it fun. And it's to me, it's in that same category of take it easy. I mean, it's a little bit abstract in a way, but yeah, it would be awesome. Yeah.
Try it.
Sweet.
Nice.
All right. Well, folks want to, after those glowing reviews, give it a try.
Yeah. So thankfully, there are copies available at Noble Knight Games. So
Noble Knight
are our sponsors that we very much appreciate.
There's a couple of editions on there. I just looked it up.
Does
that matter?
I think the rules are the same for all, as far as I understand. And I believe the edition we have is the one that is available. Maybe not, but yeah, I don't think there's any difference.
There's three different versions available on there right now.
Yeah.
There's first edition, second edition, and then another one that's unlabeled, but they're all by the same designer.
Yeah, I think they're all the same. So yeah, if you pick it up from Noble Knight, you can use our discount code 10OFFGEMS. That is 10OFFGEMS. You get 10% off of your order. We'd appreciate it if you did that. One copy on BGG Marketplace, so not a lot there, but I did check. There are also copies of this on eBay, so I anticipated that this would be positively reviewed. So if you see that copies are getting grabbed up, you might be able to get it on eBay also.
I thought you were about to say you anticipated that it would be positively reviewed, so you bought five copies.
I have one.
You can buy it at the Alley Store for $400.
But yeah, check it out. This is a good one. Like I said, small footprint, small box, totally fit in a stocking.
Fits in a stocking.
Good one.
That's a check from Hidden Gems. Cha-ching!
Check.
It does indeed fit in a stocking.
We should have had a stocking here so we could test them.
Just put them all in there.
It's one of our rating criteria. Does it indeed fit in a stocking?
All right. Well, those are our thoughts on Kryptos.
tomorrow's world is here today. A world where strange and crazy robots are built in a crackpot factory. And the player's mechanic compete to collect them all, fall off, become available on the conveyor belt.
Nice.
Nice job leaving the typos in there.
That was so good. You reminded me of, what's the guy from the 80s with the glitchy?
Max Headroom.
Max Headroom. Thank you, Bill. Yeah. I knew you'd come through for me.
Wait, what is Max Headroom?
I'll have to find like an audio effect to it.
Yeah. 0001. Yeah,
that's
one.
What I was
binary solo.
Binary solo.
Yeah, we got to get that in there. But
we must talk to the humans.
Tell us about Fizzit, Jason.
All right.
Or is it Fizzit?
I say it. Fizzit.
You should probably spell that.
FZZZT! Exclamation point!
Exclamation point!
Exclamation point's key.
It is.
All right. Published in 2009 by Eagle Griffin Games.
Mm-hmm.
Designed by Tony Boydell.
Oh, baby. I love this guy.
Yeah.
Tony.
Currently ranked.
Ivor the Engine.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Snowdonia, which we've not reviewed, but Jason and I really enjoy. And Guilds of London.
You need to bring that one on the weekend.
Snowdonia is awesome. Yeah.
Heard about it.
Currently ranked on BGG 5,324. So Fizzit is a blind bid auction game where players are attempting to accumulate the best robots and to build the most widgets. The game is made up of a deck of just 56 cards. That's the whole game. Small box game, again. Each player begins the game with a mechanic card, which is their bluffing card, and three robot cards. The rest of the deck is shuffled, and a conveyor belt is formed of 8 face-down cards in a row. Each round, players will use the bidding power of their robot cards to bid for new robots, robot upgrades, and production units. And I'll explain what those are in a minute. Players will always draw the top 6 cards from their robot draw pile, plus their mechanic bluffing card, and that is their total bidding power for a given round of 8 cards on the conveyor belt. Cards are bid upon one at a time from one end of the belt to the other. There's a mechanism by which like a randomized number of future cards are visible at any given time that I'm not going to go into in detail. But you can see a certain number of cards farther down the conveyor belt of what's coming up next. Bids are blind for each auction, simultaneously revealed, and the most lightning bolts, which is the currency that you're bidding with, wins. So if a player runs out of bidding power at any point during a round of 8 cards, they sit out the remaining auctions and don't get to bid again until the next round. So what are we bidding on? There are 4 different primary types of cards. The majority of the deck is robots. So robots have a bidding value in the top left corner,
yep,
which is from 0 to 6,
yeah,
measured in lightning bolts or zaps. Robots also have a point value between 1 and 3, and finally have some combination of parts that they are able to produce. So there are 4 different types of parts. There's oil, bolts, nuts, and gears. And each robot will have some combination of those printed at the bottom of them, indicating what they can produce. When you win a robot, you add it to your discard pile, and it becomes available for use the next round. So there is like a minor deck building element here, right? You're only drawing 6 cards off the top of your draw pile at the beginning of each round, and that is your bidding power. So you're trying to get good bidding power cards into your hand, but also eliminate bad ones, which you can do in other ways. So that's the majority of the deck. 36 out of the 40 cards or 50 cards are robots. There are 4 Fizzit cards, which are like malfunctioning robots. These have 3 lightning bolts on them, so they have a reasonable bidding power, but they produce nothing, and they're worth -1 victory point at the end of the game. There are 2 robot upgrade cards. These produce all 4 of the parts, but they're worth 0 points, and they have no bidding power. And then there are production units. There are 10 of these. And these production units are different from the robots in that if you win one of these, it goes in front of you face up on the table. And it shows some combination of parts that when assembled will produce some number of victory points. So for example, one might say if you have a bolt plus a gear, that equals 6 victory points. Yeah. Or if you have a bolt plus a gear plus a nut, that's 9 victory points, etc.
Recipe fulfillment.
Right. At the end of the game, these production unit cards can be used any number of times. That's important. They can be used any number of times to produce the listed number of victory points, so long as the player has enough robots to supply the parts to produce those things. So each robot can only supply one part of those that it's able to produce. So even if a robot can produce, like the robot upgrade cards can produce all four parts, but they can only contribute one of those parts to one production unit card at the end of the game. So it's basically a wild. At the end of the game, players will add up the points on all of their robot cards. So each robot card has a number of points. And then they will construct as many widgets as they can using the parts that they can produce with the production units that they have. We'll add up all those points together, and the winner is the one with the most points. The game ends when the conveyor belt runs out of cards, which is 5 rounds.
Mm.
And that's pretty much it.
Good job, Jason.
Nice.
Thanks, Bill.
Much better than Chris.
For a small box, small footprint game, it's kind of a little bit going on here.
Yeah, it's got a decent number of rules.
Yeah,
it does. I will say the rule book is the smallest rule book I've ever read. And it leaves a little something to be desired. There are a few ambiguous things, especially with how like the first player marker transitions around. Boy, I didn't talk about any of that kind of stuff. We house ruled a few things.
That, yeah.
Maybe we can talk about that as we go through. But the thing that I wanted to kind of kick off the conversation with was, I guess this is a weird mixture of there's an auction going on here, the blind bid.
Lots
there's also
off.
Some deck building going on. And then obviously you're doing this recipe fulfillment stuff with these production unit cards. So putting all that together, did it work for you guys? What did you think? Bill. What do you think?
Put them
I
on
kicked
the spot.
Off the last one, but okay, I'll kick off this one too. You know, I kind of think it works. I mean, you're auctioning to build your deck. So, I mean, I would say it's a deck building game, and it's like the mechanism to build your deck is to bid to get the new card that goes in. You know, the mechanisms and the conveyor belt of what you see coming in so that you can make a good decision. I have some mixed emotions about, because there are 8 cards in front of you and only a section of them are revealed on a per turn basis, right? So you have to decide, am I going to spend my wad on what I can see, or am I going to wait it out to what gets revealed later?
Because a little push your luck element.
Yeah, exactly.
Another mechanism to consider.
Right. Yeah, absolutely a push your luck element in this one. So, you know, I'm angsty to say that it worked. I mean, it's created tension, I guess. I'll say that for sure.
Yeah. So I'm going to disagree slightly.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad you went that way, because I think this will at least create some interesting discussion. Mm-hmm. And this isn't me necessarily going negative yet, but I think it should be discussed. I don't really consider this to be a deck builder.
Yeah, I mean, I use that term very loosely.
That is loose. Now, I did check. BGG says it's a deck builder. So,
and they're right.
Well, yeah, and I see what they're saying, but
I think it matters what your definition of deck builder is.
Well, that's the thing. So when I think of deck builder, I think of Dominion, where through the acquisition of cards, you're usually generating a pretty big deck out of which you're drawing 5 cards at a time. So the bigger that deck gets, the less control I have over what I'm drawing. And this game kind of gives that illusion that that is true here as well. But I felt like that your card acquisition kind of kept up with the number of cards that you were able to play to the table. So you usually will play cards that have low bid power to the table to get those out of your hand and keep your stronger bidding cards in your hand. And I feel like I was always just kind of able to keep pace there. As many times as I acquired a card, I could get it down to the table, and I was always kind of drawing 6 cards that I knew I was going to be drawing every turn.
And there's no cost to you to play those cards to the table.
Right. So it didn't really feel deck buildery to me.
Well, if you can get a recipe card out in like the first round or 2 rounds.
Well, you should try to do that.
Exactly. But if you're playing 4 players, not everybody's necessarily going
to
get one.
That's true. And there's a component of it. It wasn't strong to me. Now, I do think, and I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on this, Cameron, because we're kind of interjecting some cons, but I think it introduces interesting thoughts. You mentioned when we played it that you felt like this had a rich get richer feel to it, and you didn't like that. I don't disagree with you that it does have a rich get richer feel, but I didn't necessarily mind that because early in the game, more so than getting components to fulfill the recipe fulfillment, you don't want to fall behind in bidding power, right?
Yeah.
And so I think there's a tension there of, do I bid heavy for this card that's worth 5 bid power in the future, or, you know, 4 bid power? Or do I hold off and see what these next few cards that are face down right now, and they're going to flip face up soon, do I, you know, push my luck and maybe get something better? Or there's a tension there, I guess, in that, you know, you're trying to make that decision. Do I pull the trigger now? Do I wait? Do I try to grab these cards now and ensure that I have strong bid power in the future? Because if you do fall behind in those cards, you can really find yourself in a bad way. And I think that can be perceived as a negative and be painful. But to me, it kind of introduced a point of tension of like, I need to jump on this card because I don't want to get behind on cards that have bid strength.
Yeah.
And if that makes sense.
I feel a little bit like I should probably provide some context to that, because what I was remarking on when I made the comment about Rich Get Richer, sort of a feel to it, is has to do with the economy of bidding games in general, right? Like auction games. Like there's an unstated economy of like what the value of something is, right? And in this game, it would be, what is the value of a 3 lightning bolt? What is the value of a 4? What's the value of a 5?
Right.
The problem that
Very important early.
The problem that I felt is that if in the first couple of rounds you have one or two players that are able to acquire a 4 lightning bolt or a 5 lightning bolt card, their economy has changed in terms of what quote unquote worth it is, or what bidding high means for them. Because bidding high for me is like 4 or 5. Bidding high for you is like 7 or 8.
Because they have a lot more
You have a lot more to throw at things. And so
you have to bid high for those cards, right?
Well, but what I'm saying is that if you get behind by not picking up some of those bigger cards to begin with, like earlier on in the first couple of rounds, bidding high still means like 6, when bidding high for other players means like 9, right? And so you get to the
but
place.
But not in the first round.
I understand
because everybody starts with the same bid.
I understand
power.
That. And that's what I'm saying, is that you have to swing high early so that you're not one of the people who's sitting there going, well, I only have 7 in my hand.
Or if you don't win that bid because you didn't swing high enough, the person that did win it basically
is now depleted.
Is now depleted. Right. Because I'll stop talking because I don't want to be talking the whole time, but there are 8 cards up for auction in a 4-player game. So they might have got that really strong card, but maybe that's the only card they get for the round because you forced them to just go for broke for that one card. And now you get 2 cards and they only get 1 card.
But what you can't let happen is for you to not have built up your economy and your bidding power in the cards that you acquire, right? You haven't necessarily really strengthened your bidding power that much. And so the next round, you're going to be sitting there going, well, I can't outbid Chris, because Chris has a 5 in his hand, you know, something like that.
Right, but even in that situation, it's subjective at that point. What does Chris want, right? Because
that's a good point.
He could continue to go after the 5 lightning bolt cards every time they come up, and like, yeah, because he has more bidding power, he can grab it from everybody else. But if you do that, you're probably not getting the parts that you need.
That may not fulfill my recipe.
Like fulfill your recipes and do all that stuff. Right?
Well, and I think that maybe the point that I'm making is that what matters maybe more than understanding your own sense of the economy of the game and what something is worth is actually tracking what other people are picking up and understanding what you think they will be able to bid on something and what they value.
Very tempted to draw a parallel between this and Phoenicia. I'm not going to do it because it's been too long and I don't fully remember
it. Don't trigger me.
But I feel like there's some parallels here of like, you really got to pick your battles and understand where to bid and where not to.
Well, and I think maybe this is a comparison to that, because I think in that one, you actually lose your bid if you go in and you don't win. Whereas in this one, if you go in and you swing with all your might and you just can't outbid somebody, you do get your bid back.
And you're at least forcing every other winner to spend more than you have in your hand.
Right.
Bill?
I agree on that first round that everybody can swing the defenses. I don't think it breaks the game necessarily, because I think you could possibly catch up. Even if somebody gets a 5 bid or 2 5 bids in the first, I don't think that guarantees they're going to win the game. I think in the second round you could do something to catch up or whatever. Right. Well, so I don't think that that's necessarily it, but I think there is that component. I think they have an advantage.
Okay. Any other thoughts? We've kind of mixed pros and cons. This is a contentious game. I had a feeling this was coming.
Yeah. I knew this one wasn't going to go as smooth as
I will say one thing. This is a con for me. I always have an issue, and now granted, we did always play this with four players, and this is uniquely a four-player issue, but even with three, this could rear its head. In a four-player game with eight auctions, generally speaking, unless somebody bids a whole lot for one card, which could happen, but generally speaking, everybody at the table knows I need to win two auctions, right? And so if everybody kind of knows that going in, right, as long as I win two auctions here, I'm okay. Right. And then the next round, I need to win two auctions here. And I felt like we were kind of seeing that play out. I don't know. It just felt predictable. You know, I feel like in auction games, you have to have that fear of like, if I don't win this auction, I'm screwed. Right. Mm-hmm. And that usually mechanistically plays out in the way of like you get left out. In a four player game, there are only three auctions. That's just like a basic example. But it's like somebody's not going to get something.
Right.
So it's like I have to like
swing for the fences.
Right, right. Well, I have to try to get a part of that. Whereas in an eight auctions in a four player game, it's like, well, if I get two, then I'm okay, right?
Yeah,
right.
I don't disagree. I totally disagree.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you may get two, but there are good cards out there and there are crap cards out there. So.
Well, sure. But I mean,
if you get two good cards and I get two crap cards, then you're going to
I think if I get a good card and an average card that fulfills my recipe, I'm happy.
Right.
I was grabbing a lot of one value cards last game, and I almost won. I mean, it was and 1 point
I think that's actually one of the things that we haven't really talked about is the way that the game scores. We've been talking a lot about what it takes to get the buying power, like the lightning bolts on the cards and the complications that we felt, you know, we encountered with that. But one of the most important aspects of the game is acquiring the recipes to fulfill. And then
can I score this
and then
card?
Fulfilling them, right? So that does kind of enter into and add some complexity to the bidding where the card that you're bidding on has an oil on it. And you're like, well, I know Chris has a recipe with an oil on it. Maybe he wants to, you know, acquire it to fulfill his recipe, you know. And so who knows what you would be willing to put on that in order to get those points. Right, because ultimately what really matters is how many points can you score.
Yeah.
Right, the lightning bolts are just the way to get there.
Yeah, it may not be worth a lot of bid power, but I could turn it into points at the end of the game, right?
Right.
So I'm happy to get that card.
So you and your production cards are public, right? So it's like I know that you need whatever gears and oil cards to get there. So
yeah. I mean, like any good auction game, you have to be paying attention to like the value of things for other players at the table, not just for yourself. Yeah.
Are you ready for a final thought?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I think this game is super confusing. I'm sorry, listeners. I'm just sitting here listening to our thoughts.
Yeah.
And I think we're all making really good points. And I think they're valid. And I'm sitting here thinking
no way
they're not
going to
understand what we're talking about. This is a weird one, right? Yeah. It is this idea of bid power versus how many points is it actually worth is...
I mean, it's like a multi-use card auction game.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
What'd you think, Jason?
This game surprised me in that when I first read the rules, I was like, this is going to be terrible. This game is not going to be good. It's going to flop. And then I played it the first time. Actually, we played this at the getaway weekend last year.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I played it only one time. And I was kind of underwhelmed. I was like... Maybe it's okay. I don't know. Hard to tell. And then when we played it here, I was kind of more surprised by, I was like, okay, there's some things to think about here.
Yeah,
some things to chew on. All that said, do I like the game is really the question when you boil it down. I think there are things to think about here. And I think, you know, some of the qualms that we have about it aside, I think there's a legitimate auction game here. You have to be looking at what other people want. You have to be like trying to balance, well, do I go for the high bidding card or do I go for the things that actually produce the stuff that I need? Which production units do I get? Do I try to get a lot of production units and fulfill all of them once? Do I try to go for just like one production unit and save my money for all the robots and try to fulfill that one as many times as I can? Like there are dimensions to it. And we saw like my son won this game the first time we played it. And he won. He had like five different production units and fulfilled each one time. I was like, how did you even do that?
Yeah, that was wild.
Whereas like I won a game one time and I only had one production unit.
I just hammered it
a bunch of times, right? So I think it's not a like one method to victory type game. And so that intrigues me. All that said, though, playing it, I'm like, do I want to keep playing this game? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to keep playing it. There are better auction games.
Recipes fulfillment games.
Yeah, it's not a short game.
Right.
Despite its stocking stuffer size. So, like, and I think if you've listened to this podcast for a while, you know that I really enjoy auction games. So maybe a little harder on this one than I would be on another game because I really like auction games and we've played a lot of really good ones.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for me, while I think that there is more game here than I expected there to be for the size of the game that it is, I think I was between a 3 and a 4, and I think the more we've talked about it, the more I've fell to the 3 side on it. And it, like, I think it's worth trying if you like auction games and you want something
you
small
need
and
to
short.
Like auctions.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. Like, if you don't like auction games, you're going to hate this.
Yeah, no way. Right? Yeah.
But for me, there are better auction games out there that fit the same bill. And so it just fell kind of into the meh 3 category, unfortunately. Yeah.
Interesting. I won't wax too long here because your thoughts are very similar to mine. I was so torn on this game. I didn't dislike my plays of it. Like Jason said, there are things to think about. I enjoyed kind of teasing out some of those nuances. But one thing I will say that I've kind of hinted at, but we haven't talked about in detail that I'll just mention really quickly, is it's fairly repetitive.
Mm.
So this game is typically 5 rounds long and it's 8 auctions each round. So you're just doing 40 auctions in a row. Okay.
And there's only 40 cards and they're not super varied. So it's like, I mean, I know pretty much what's going to come up next, even if some of it's hidden.
So you're doing 40 blind bid auctions in a row. You have to really, I think, enjoy auctions to enjoy this one. And I do like auctions a lot. But I think for this one, it's just missing something. And it's hard for me to even point my finger on what it is. But something is missing to make me want to come back to it. I didn't not like it. But would I want to continue playing it? I don't think so. So I'm kind of where Jason is. I'm kind of in the 3 category. It's not bad, but it's just okay. It's just meh. So I'm going to give it a 3 also.
All right.
Fire away.
Okay. So here's where I'm at with this one. Okay. So there are so many really fun auction games. Yeah. I'm not coming at this
Strasbourg, baby.
From a place of like, I don't like auction games. There are a lot of games that I really like auction. Like, I mean, Medici is one of my favorite games and I love it. And I've had a lot of fun. We've explored so many. I mean, even like back to like episode 1, I'm thinking about, oh my gosh, the circus game.
Spectaculum.
Spectaculum. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Like, so good. And, you know, what I'm thinking about, that's actually not an auction game, is it?
Not really. But
what am I thinking about? We played an early on auction game anyway.
Nefertiti.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking about. Okay. So, I mean, like, so many good ones. And I felt like in all of those games, I could track the economy. Like, I could estimate in my mind before the bidding happens, like, what the value of a thing is worth.
Mm-hmm.
I could not do that in this game because it changed after basically the first round.
Mm.
And I couldn't track 3 other people's sense of the economy of the game. And that troubled me like a lot. Yeah. And I played
if you're the outside looking in, it
many times. Exactly.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. When I play a game and the game itself makes me stop caring about it, that's a bad sign. It's a bad sign for me. If I'm 2/3 of the way through the game and I don't care anymore, the game has failed. Right. And that's not the player's fault. And that's not my fault for like not performing well, right? Like that's not a performance problem. The game has become uninteresting to me, which means that it's bad. Okay. So I'm landing on
depressed.
Or I'm depressed, generally speaking, but I know that I'm not depressed. Therefore the game is bad. All right. So I'm landing on a 2 for this one. I didn't really have much fun playing it. I don't want to play it again. If it comes out again, I'm going to go do something else or stare at my phone or something because that would be more fun. So it's a 2.
Love it.
Bye. All
right. Okay. Well, I am depressed by this game. It was funny because I was one of the ones who played it at the last retreat, and I kind of remembered kind of like vaguely not liking it when we pulled it out again. I was like, okay, let's see if there's something different here. And it was like, oh yeah, I don't like this game. I mean, really, there's so much around that first player person about pulling in that very first 5-star bid thing, 5 lightning bolts, that they have so much power later. And it's like, okay, now let me see if I can get back into this at all. And Chris, I think you hit the nail on the head with about how repetitive it is. It's just, I'm doing this over and over and over again. And I don't know, I'm just bad at auction games. I will say I'm the one at the table who's not necessarily super excited about auction games. There were so many times that I ended up at the end of those 8 cards with like all my money in front of me because I had not won any auctions. And I'm getting a card at the very last. It's like, oh my, why am I even here?
But those face down cards are so enticing.
They are. It's like,
I gotta
man,
wait. There could be right. really good,
there
right?
There's some good candy here. I mean, there could be another game where I could have like really won. Like the times that you won a couple cards with one bid, right?
Yeah.
That was that was really good for you. Anyway, I'm going to give it a 2-2. I would.
Yeah, let's go.
I would rather, you know,
Christmas
lay in
cheer.
The grass and
make
bug snow angels and then play this one again.
Oh, man.
This is not. This
Jason,
not
maybe
me.
One day you'll bring one of your games from your collection that's actually good.
Yeah, it's not working out so well lately.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's funny.
It never works out.
You need to pick the better ones.
I know. I'm sorry. It was the smallest game you have, so it made the cut.
But look, if you want to maybe give this one as a gift to someone you don't like for Christmas, where could you find it?
Well, there are copies on Noble Knight as low as $6.50, which
sounds
doesn't
about right.
qualify for our discount code. You actually have to spend at least $10 to get our 10% off, but you can buy something else.
There's one in my collection, and I will charge you more than $10 for it if you'd like.
Right.
This game is so bad, you can't even use our coupon on it.
Yeah, but if you add something else to your cart, you can use our coupon code 10OFFGEMS and get 10% off your order. It's also 10 copies on the BGG Marketplace.
So give it to a neighbor you don't like.
There you go. That's right.
Cameron, did you buy Kryptos while we were sitting here?
No.
Somebody did.
Everybody's fighting over who's going to get Kryptos.
But I did slip Chris's game into my bag.
Oh, there you go.
Nice. All right. Well, those are our thoughts on
in realms where suits adorn a gaming stage, where players weave their fortunes, skill engage, a trick-taking dance unfolds in sweet refrain, where cards in hand like muses mark the game. 4 suits entwine a tapestry unveiled, a game of wits where strategies are hailed, with every play a chance to seize the lead, like jesters in a prank with tricks decreed. Yet in this realm, a twist of fate does spin, for sticks, like alchemists, can change the din. A cunning choice to alter numbers' course adds mystery and depth, a subtle force. In trickery's dance, where players enthrall with suits and sticks, a sonnet to enthrall.
Holy crap!
Chat GPT is freaky, man.
That
I was
going to
say, did
Chat
you write
GPT.
That while I was
nope.
making yeah. the drink? Chat
just,
GPT did yeah. that?
Yes. I just told Chat GPT about
we're
this game
doomed.
And
we
asked it to write.
Skynet, we're
holy
dead.
I just asked Chat GPT to write a sonnet about a very good description
dead.
Of this game.
It is over for us.
Seriously.
That was a sonnet, everybody.
The machines have won.
All right,
I'm just
going to
say, I've never written a sonnet in my life.
That was unbelievable.
That was freaking awesome, and it is. It's like the game. Chris doesn't even need to explain the rules now.
Just mic drop. That's all you need. You know everything
holy
you
crap.
Need to know about this game.
All right, well, that's awesome. I guess I'll speak now.
Yeah. All right, for everyone, this is actually Chris.
Jeez. All right. Wow. Twinkle Starship. Published in 2020, not 2012, as we usually do. So pretty recent.
Okay.
Published by Twin Lions Do and Kentucky. At the time of this recording, its BGG ranking is 7,401. Designer of this game, Taiki Shinzawa. We know this guy, the designer of Ghosts of Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
American Bookshop, mm-hmm. Nine Lives, and many other trick-taking games.
Very cool.
This guy is a trick-taking game specialist, and we reviewed Ghosts of Christmas on this podcast before pretty darn favorably.
I think
pretty much across the board. And we've talked about American Bookshop, I think maybe on Backstage. I didn't like that one as much.
Yeah, we kind of poo-pooed on it a little
Yeah,
bit. But it was interesting initially. But
interesting
then,
idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of just takes these trick-taking games and just comes up with really clever stuff. It's kind of his shtick.
Mm.
All right, so brief rule summary for Twinkle Starship. Jason, I get to explain a trick-taking game this time.
Yeah, I don't have to do it. Thanks.
Yeah. So Twinkle Starship is a trick-taking card game where players can change the value of their played cards on the fly through the use of small wooden sticks. I'll explain more in a moment. But before I do that, I should talk about standard trick-taking, as Jason often does, because this game follows standard trick-taking conventions.
I dare you to do it better than I do.
I probably won't. So, Twinkle Starship, the deck is four suits, so four different colors of cards, and the cards are numbered 0 through 8. Or is it 9?
Bill, what are you doing?
What are you doing, Bill? You're distracting me.
I gave Cameron a shadow projecting theater, and I'm playing shadows now with my bottle cap.
Bill is loose as a goose right now.
if you're not a Patreon subscriber,
I highly recommend
Bill,
whiskey.
Are you making shadow puppets?
I am.
With a toothpick and a beer bottle.
It is. I'm playing like spaceship.
Going off the rails.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. Back to the rules.
I'm going to try to concentrate here. I'm just going to
trick-taking game. Standard.
Well, like you said, the world is over after that Sonic. I mean, I'm holy crap. I don't need to do anything for the rest of my freaking life is what I'm thinking.
All right, Bill. Dial it back.
All right. Standard trick taking. So let me explain. So like I said, four suits, number 0 to 8, or is it 0 to 9? We'll talk about that in a minute.
Good question.
That's a good question. Like most trick takers, if somebody leads with a certain color of card, you need to follow suit. So in other words, if Jason leads green, if you're holding a green card in your hand, you must play a green card. If you don't have green card in your hand, you can play whatever suit you want. It's important to understand that in this particular game, the red suit is the trump suit. And what that means is that if Jason plays green and everybody follows suit with green, whoever played the high card will win the trick. However, if somebody plays off suit and they play trump, that trump will win the trick. Whoever played the highest trump. Okay, and again, in this game, that's the red suit, okay? I will also mention, and this is very important, as I said before, the suits are numbered 0 to 8, and the numbers on the cards have the appearance of a digital number. So think about, like, if you were to look at an alarm clock and how
old
the numbers...
Old school 80s alarm clock.
What's that?
An old school 80s
Like an old school 80s alarm clock, how those numbers look.
With the LED lines lit
like,
up.
Exactly. Like rupees from Zelda.
They look like that. Right. That matters. You may be thinking, why does that matter? It matters. Okay. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. At the start of each hand, each player will receive 6 small wooden sticks. When a player plays a card to a trick, they can take some of these sticks and place them onto the card to change the played number into a different number. So let me give you some examples.
The sticks are shaped like rupees from Zelda.
Right. They're shaped like rupees from Zelda. So if I play a 0, I can play the 0 to the table, and then I can take a single stick, a rupee from Zelda, and I can lay it horizontally through that 0, and I have now changed that 0 into an 8.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense? Let's use another example. Let's consider a 7. I can take that 7, and I can lay 3 sticks and turn that 7 into a 0. Or I could lay 4 sticks and turn that 7 into an 8. Right? So you can see how you can take your played card and change it into a lot of different numbers. And even a 1 can become a 3, a 7, an 8, a 9, a 0.
Actually, a 1 can only become a 0 because it's a left aligned.
It's right aligned.
Left aligned.
It's right aligned.
Positive that it's left aligned.
You should definitely keep arguing about this.
Okay, whatever. All right, let me give you another example. A 5 can become an 8 or a 9. How about that?
Yeah.
All right.
But a 2 cannot.
One other thing I'll mention is a 6, if you flip it upside down, will become a 9.
Yeah.
And that's why I was kind of making a joke about, is it 0 to 8 or 0 to 9? Because 6s, depending on how you orient them when you play them at the table, can actually be played as a 9.
Just want the record to show that I'm showing Chris a 1.
Dude, you can turn it like this, though.
Oh, man, that's a good point.
And make it a 3. Get out of here.
Man, I've really limited myself in the last game with all my 1s.
Okay.
Thought I could only play them as left aligned.
Ignore Cameron. All right.
It's both aligned. You're both right.
Oh, man. It is.
See, I'm the peacemaker here.
So I will also mention, this is important, in the event of a tie, because ties are frequent in this game because you can turn cards into different numbers. In the event of a tie, if more than one person plays the same highest number, whoever played the tied card later will win the trick. So if I make my card a 9 and then Cameron after me turns his card into a 9 or he just plays a 9, Cameron would win the trick because he played after me. All right. So there's more. So another catch is, and this is important, and this is probably the most interesting thing about this game, the number of unused sticks in front of you at the end of the hand must exactly equal the number of tricks that you caught in the round. So as I mentioned before, you start with 6 sticks. So let's say I play 4 sticks during the round to turn cards into different numbers. That will leave 2 sticks in front of me unplayed. That will mean that in order for me to score points this round, I will have to have caught 2 tricks exactly.
Mm-hmm.
If I catch 3 sticks, or I'm sorry, if I catch 3 tricks and I have 2 sticks in front of me, I scored nothing, okay?
Tricks equals sticks.
Tricks equals sticks, okay? So that's really important to understand. If a player got their bid right, they will score 2 points for every trick they caught. And then in addition, they'll score an additional point for each stick that was used by the players during the caught trick. So for example, let's say I caught a trick where Cameron turned a 1 into a 0, okay? So he would have used 4 sticks to do that.
Which is the only thing I would have done, actually.
Right.
It's the only thing I thought I could do.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Because Cameron used 4 sticks to turn that 1 into a 0, and I caught that trick, I'll catch those 4 sticks, and that's 4 points, in addition to the 2 points I get for catching the trick. Okay? Now, if you shoot the moon, this is important. So by shooting the moon, I mean that you catch no tricks and you have no sticks left in front of you. So you used all your sticks to alter numbers and you caught no tricks, 0-0, you will score 10 points for the round. No tricks, no sticks. At the end of 4 rounds, the player with the most points wins the game. And that's generally how you play Twinkle Starship.
Well done.
Yeah.
Sorry for interjecting.
That's okay. We're having a good time right now.
It's Christmas.
This review is going to be rough, but we'll get through it. All right. So my question is, how do you feel about the sticks? That's the obvious place to start, right? Because generally speaking, this game follows standard trick-taking conventions, like most trick-takers do.
Right.
Especially by this particular designer, but he will take trick-taking, and then he'll just interject or add one little thing that kind of makes it weird. Yeah. And in this particular instance, it's that he gives you these sticks to where you can change the face value of a card, but also keeping in mind that the number of sticks that you don't use is your bid for the round.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that?
Yeah. I'll jump in on this one because I thought this was a fascinating concept. Because you're so used to in these trick-taking games, you get your hand of cards and you're looking at them and you're like, okay, these are my limits.
Right.
Like this is what I have to work with. But that's not true in this game.
You're making an assessment at the start
before
a card is played.
You almost have to have some level of understanding of what the numbers that you're holding in your hand could become Mm-hmm. And that includes turning them upside down and potentially adding 1 to 5, usually, like, sticks to them. And the big question becomes, when is it appropriate to use a certain any number of sticks, right? Because, and I'm sure we'll talk about this as well, anytime that you play sticks to the table, if you're not placing them in such a way to make your number a really high number that wins you the trick, you're giving your sticks to somebody else as points.
Yeah, you're giving points to other players, yeah.
Which is a tough gamble unless you're shooting the moon, right? Yeah. In which case, you might be going, that's a great opportunity to get rid of a bunch of sticks. So I thought it was a really interesting element to add to the game to kind of add this sort of malleable layer.
It's a good word
to this game, right? It's like, oh, this isn't just a 3. Maybe it's an 8.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I love the shifting bid concept because everything you do is modifying your bid throughout the hand.
Yes. Right?
So you have the ability. It's not just like, well, I make this bid at this beginning of the hand and that's my target. I have to hit that target. Or if I don't have that target, I'm screwed.
Right.
Right. You can like kind of be loosey goosey with your target and be like, okay, well, I can play with my target.
Yeah.
But if I play too much with it or I get too greedy, then I might screw myself. Yeah. Right.
You can change it on the last card played.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
You could be like, oh, I thought I was going to take that trick, but actually I'm going to change this and throw it under.
Yeah.
Right.
Like one of the coolest things that I liked about that I realized throughout was like, I mean, you can feed yourself points. You can use your own sticks
right.
on a number that you know is a winner. And give those sticks right back to yourself.
Yeah.
However, when you do that, you've just scrunched your bid down.
Yeah. Right.
Like if I can play a 1 and add 4 sticks to it and make it a 0, Cameron. And like I just gave myself 4 points if I win that trick. You probably right. wouldn't win with a 0, but just
unless it's
go,
a trial.
Just go with it, you know. But when I do that, now I'm saying you're I'm only winning 2 tricks.
Right.
And if I win more than that, then I'm
all
screwed,
the sticks
right?
you caught are for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really loved that like push pull element.
Yeah. The example there would be I turned a 1 into an 8, and now I have 1 stick left, and this is the only trick that I won
because
I won it with an 8.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's funny because I felt like I had a little bit of a love hate relationship to it in that when I looked at my hand, you know, I want to be able to say this is how I plan the game. And I'm a fuzzy logic kind of guy, right?
Yeah.
So I do like fuzzy logic. However, those first, I don't know, three or four cards that you play, you know, it kind of sets the stage of what you're going to try to do next, right? I mean, it's like,
yeah,
this game really has a very defined, at least beginning and end part. I don't know about the middle part, but the beginning, you can end up taking, you know, 3 or 4 tricks at the beginning just because everybody else is changing their cards to force you into doing it. And you might have thought, well, I'm going to go low this time. And all of a sudden you have 4 tricks that you didn't know that you were going to get. And so at that point, you know, the game becomes, all right, how do I make sure I'm still going to keep 4 sticks down here and get rid of the rest of them or whatever? So it's I don't know, this is on a per trick basis, you're really thinking about what I need to do now to kind of narrow in on that matching, which is sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't, but it's kind of a fun mental exercise anyway.
Yeah, the idea of the fluid bid is just really interesting. Jason, you were speaking of this, and I'll just piggyback off of it because I want to reinforce it because I think this was really interesting. A lot of trick-taking games, you have to bid exactly from the start, right? Like you were just saying, Bill, you look at your starting hand of cards, you're like, okay, this is my starting hand. I'm trying to find a pathway. I think I'm going to catch this many cards. That's my bid. And you're locked in at that point. Whereas in this particular game, you might have an idea about paths that you might travel down, but you need to be flexible, right? Because you might think you're catching 1, but you're actually catching 4. And now you're like, well, I have to have 4 sticks in front of me or I'm going to get 0 points, right? So you're adjusting on the fly, right? Yeah. That bid is fluid and you're adjusting to that on the fly. And I think one of the things I found really interesting is that the game for me really kind of started when I had like 5 cards left in my hand. It's like, how many tricks have I caught? How many tricks do I think I might still catch? And then even more importantly than that, and this is one of the things I thought was the most interesting, is what cards am I going to play to leave cards in my hand to where I can fiddle with my sticks? That sounds weird.
Fiddle sticks.
Fiddle sticks.
Fiddle with my sticks to make sure I can shift my bid to not go set on myself. Yeah. Right.
So you had to keep cards back that were more flexible than others.
Right. To keep cards back that were flexible and that I could actually make a viable number. This game is unique in that you're not just deciding upon what card you played at a trick to decide if you're going to catch it or not. For me, I was thinking about what card do I not play?
Yeah.
Because I need to have it in my hand in case I have to adjust my bid
right.
on the fly at the end so I don't get screwed, right? And I don't score any points, right? That was just so weird.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, we talk about...
I don't say that as a bad thing. It was just unusual, right?
We've talked on this podcast for a long time about the importance of tension in a game. And I think that that exact thing that you just described is the thing that adds tension to the game, right? The very fact that if I equal the number of tricks with the number of sticks that I have left, then I've scored some points. Maybe not a winning number, maybe not the most for the round, but some points. But if I don't, I get zero.
Yeah, which is a
killer. It creates anxiety for the player, and that is gold for a game, I think. Right? It adds that tension. How do I figure that out? How do I score at least something, if not the most points this round? Right?
Mm-hmm. And then you add on top of that the fact that you can shoot the moon, which I feel like is great addition to
we got
to
talk about this.
If,
yeah.
if it's like a viable strategy.
Right.
That adds in that other tension. It's like, okay, well, my plans are going awry.
That's right.
But maybe I can shoot the moon.
All right. And how valuable is shooting the moon? And I think that like that's a question to review. It's like, do you think that the number of points assigned
they got it
if
right.
you do shoot your moon, did they get it right?
Yeah. I think in some games they screw up in that shooting the moon isn't worth it.
It's not valuable enough.
10 points in this game is pretty good, right? And then another thing that's really good about this game is the risk of shooting the moon is good too. Like, like if you're trying to shoot the moon and not catch any tricks, you're scoring a lot of points. But if you catch just one trick, you're scoring 2 points, which is almost as bad as going set.
Yeah.
Like it's a disaster.
Yeah.
If you only score 2 points, right?
You're
so like
to
if you're thinking
trick.
About shooting the moon, you have to like think carefully about it.
Which makes
if you catch one, you've screwed yourself.
Which makes attempting it fun. Which like I mean, I succeeded at that a couple times and it was a fun round when I was doing that. I was like, all right, what do I need to do? How do I work it out? I need to get rid of these sticks. I got to be creative about that. I need to be able to toss them in when I know I'm going to toss off suit or something
like
that.
I got to get rid of cards that are liabilities.
Exactly.
Right.
Get rid of my high cards, whatever.
Yeah.
And
not
and so,
feed all of my 6 sticks to the same player.
Exactly. Right. Like
so they score 16 points and I scored 10.
I mean, to me, I feel like it's a little underpowered because you're giving away 10 points, right?
That's fair.
You're giving away
That's
6
fair.
Points.
Yeah.
No. Why?
1 point per stick, right?
Oh, you only have 6 points. Okay, you're right. You're right. You're giving away 6 points.
And
so you could argue
you're giving away all the tricks that you did.
Yeah, like
right. Sure, right.
Potentially helping someone win a trick.
Right. And so to me, there was never an incentive really to try to set the person that you knew was going low because it became really apparent that Cameron was going low a lot. And it was like, okay.
Was it? That
yeah. It was pretty obvious.
When, he likes to do that.
Exactly. When he was turning this 7 into a 0 on round 2, you kind of figured that's okay, he's going low this time.
But I mean, he sticks for that.
But the rest of us, I mean, it made no sense for us to give up stuff necessarily for all three of us to try to set Cameron. There wasn't like he was going to go minus 100, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. To me, it's I can go either way. It's not like a game breaker, but I could see if you made it higher, it would just change the dynamic a little bit.
I do think that it would be almost more difficult to force the person that you think is shooting the moon to take a trick than it would be to just shoot the moon yourself. Like, I think that would be like quite an accomplishment. If you're like, well, Chris is shooting the moon, I'm going to throw this way so that he definitely takes this trick. So that I can screw him over from shooting the moon.
Well, I mean,
I guess it's doable.
That's devastating to do.
I mean, I
lost the first game because of that.
Really?
Yeah, right. I was cruising the first time we played this, and then I tried to shoot the moon, and I ended up with 1 trick,
2 points.
Yeah,
because of Bill. I will point that out.
Yes, because of Bill. Final thoughts?
Should we?
Sure.
Okay. I'm starting. Yes, I am, aren't I? Oh, gosh. Okay. Where to start here? So I will say the first time we played this game,
You were hating life.
I didn't have fun. I think that was a combination of me not having a good day / everybody getting it and me not getting it. Everybody was making their bids and I wasn't. I was like, golly, I'm an idiot. / And I will mention this, and Bill, you mentioned this earlier in the review, and I will reiterate it. For me personally, when I'm playing a trick-taking game where you're trying to be precise on your bid, mm-hmm. I like to look at my hand of cards and see a pathway mm-hmm. or a few different pathways that I think are viable. That is not in this game.
Yeah.
Okay. And I will say that is kind of a minor con, right? The first like 4 to 5 tricks of this game, in my opinion, are kind of irrelevant. The more I played this game, the more when I got my star in a hand of cards, I didn't even really think about it because I was like, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Because everything that I think I'm going to catch with or not catch with is totally up in the air.
So glad I'm going after you.
I'm like, oh, I have an 8. Meaningless. I have a 0. That won't catch anything. Wrong. I caught with 0s several times in this game because people turned 7s into 0s. And then I played my 0 after them and caught. Right? So you can't look at your hand to start and be like, okay, I know how I'm going to play this hand. What you do in this game is the first 4 to 5 tricks, you just play them out, see how it falls, see how many tricks you've caught, and then you start to decide, okay, how am I going to make it work? I'm not necessarily saying that's good or bad. That's not what I'm usually looking for in a trick-taking game, but once I accepted that, and that's how the game is supposed to be played, and I shouldn't try to play the game the way I want to play it, but I'm trying to play it the way that it's meant to be designed, and I accepted that, I enjoyed it more. You just have to know that going in, that like, if you're used to like looking at your hand and having a plan, no. It's tactical early, strategic later. Mm-hmm. And then once I kind of come to grips with that, I found that I enjoyed it more. So all that to say, I think the game is good. Are there trick-taking games I like more than this? Yeah. I think Ghost of Christmas by the same designer is a much better game than this. I enjoy it more. But I liked this one. I'm going to give it a 4. It's good. If people wanted to play it, I would play it. I think it's super unique. It is so unique. There's no trick taker like this. The idea of changing your numbers with sticks, cool. But I'm going to stop at a 4. It's good. I like it. I'll play it. It's not my favorite, but I didn't dislike it. Does that make sense?
Sure. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
That's where I'm going to stop with it.
Great. Awesome. Well, Chris, I actually think, ironically enough, you did a great job describing a lot of my thoughts about this. Like, I did find this game pretty difficult to wrap my brain around to begin with. I mean, I think it wasn't until we played it a second time that mm-hmm. I really started to, like, change my mindset, thinking about each trick and thinking about each hand of cards. And understanding that, like, I could actually find a pathway in a different way than I normally would with, right. like, Teach You or, like, you know, some of these other yep. trick-taking type games. Teach You's not a trick-taking game.
But you're right. But I thought, like, the same thing. Like, with Teach You, like, when I look at my hand, I'm like, okay, I kind of know what I'm going to do.
Pathway, yeah.
Right, right.
You yeah. see, okay, I'm going to take with that. I'm going to take with that. I'm right, going to right. throw under with this. Yeah, when you start thinking about it differently and you start thinking, like, well, I could get rid of this one if I do it, if I, you know, put sticks on this and like change it to that or whatever, like, and you can start to understand, you know, what your options are and what you really need to be aiming for. Cause here's the reality. Like, you can't just approach this going like, well, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and I'll take one trick and I'll get when I'll have one stick left.
Yeah, I did that, and I went set every time.
Because if you do that, you might score points, but you're not going to score many points. You need to figure out, like, how do I take...
just going
to
be wrong.
How do I take 3 tricks and leave 3 sticks left? Like, how do I take 4 tricks and take 4 sticks left? Like, if you can do it, that's how you're going to score more than 10 points a game. Otherwise, you do need to be thinking about, what is it going to take to shoot the moon? And how do I engineer that? Which I honestly really enjoyed as a puzzle for this game. I think it's fun in Ghost of Christmas, and I think it's fun in this game. Having the option to shoot the moon mm-hmm. when you get kind of a crummy hand is a great, like, I don't want to call it a catch-up mechanism, but it's like a neutral pass for the round.
You can't complain about having bad cards.
Right. It doesn't put you far behind, right, just because mm-hmm. you got bad cards. Which I think is a great savior for a trick-taking game. Because, like, Let's be honest. Every time I play trick taking games with Jason, if he gets bad cards, he complains a lot about it. You know? And everyone's
and everyone's
inclined to do that. If you think that you just got dealt a bad hand, like you want to blame the game and like having mechanisms like that, like you can't really.
I get dealt bad cards on repeat every time I play Teacher with Chris.
If you just get dealt bad cards. All right. So you can shoot the moon, and if you can pull it off with your skill and your wisdom of understanding how to play, great. That keeps the game fun. So for me, this was a fun one for me. Mm. Honestly, I really enjoyed it. I did win. Maybe that does influence my rating.
You did. Yeah.
But it clicked for me.
You and played like, well. Yeah.
And it was like, okay, I think I know what to do. I want to try this time. That's a good sign for me. And so for me, this is above average. This is like, I do want to play this one again. I might be inclined to acquire a copy if it's not nice. Like that hard to acquire. Maybe worth teaching to some of my friends who also like card games. So that's a good sign for me. I really enjoyed it. I think it's above average. So that's a 5.
Nice.
Okay. Ooh, nice. All right, Cameron. I'll say I enjoyed it too. I mean, I wonder if the gadgetry part of this game will have legs over time. I do feel like the first part of the game, for me anyway, I was like looking to get rid of my 2 and 8s because they're like non-adjustable. Right. Yeah. So you don't want to have those late in the game, depending on what happens. One of the things I don't think we talked about too much is sometimes you'll be presented with like somebody's or people put out like 5 or 6 sticks that are out there on the trick in front of you. And you're thinking that you're not going to be taking that. And that's like, you know, 4 tricks worth of value right there in one trick. And so it was like, okay, can I make this work with what I have in my hand to pull this in?
That's a really great point.
So it is very much an opportunistic game.
Yeah.
Right. And the flip side to that is sometimes you'll lead with something and then all of a sudden there'll be, you know, 6 other points out there and somebody else will pick it up. And it's like, and that's just totally out of your control.
Totally.
Right. Which is, I guess, the nature of this kind of game. But I did enjoy it. I did like the spatial nature of it, but now I've kind of understand that that's how it works. Again, I'm not 100%. I've got a lot of legs with it, but it is like a curio game, Chris. I think in other episodes you've said this is kind of a cool thing to pull off my shelf and show people and say, hey.
You there's know, nothing like it.
There's nothing like it. Let's try it. Let's play it. Let's, you know, see what you guys think. And it's just kind of, I think it would be fun to show other people. So to me, it kind of falls in that category. I'm not sure I necessarily want to play it a lot. Or I would play it with you guys, and especially if you guys got interested in it, I think I would, just to see how much depth it has. But to me, right now, it's in that curio mode. So I'm going to give it a 4.
Nice. I like the differing opinions on this game. It's been good. I think, for me, I think I disagree slightly with you, Chris. Not entirely, but slightly, in the terms of, like, you can't know anything about your initial hand.
Oh, boy.
Like,
yeah, I disagree.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to claim that this is a teach you style game.
There's no winner you can in know. Your hand in this game to start. The well, 9 there, of no, red, the not. Highest trump card is not a winner in this game.
Right. You can't guarantee that anything's a winner, but you can look at your hand and you can evaluate strength or weakness. And you can start to say, okay, well, I know I have the 8 of green, right? Which may not win,
that
right? Because because somebody could flip something to a 9, but I know that it's a liability in my hand.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. I know that it's a strong card that I need to do something about if I'm not prepared to take a trick with it. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm not prepared to take a trick with that, then I need to do something about it. And you can start to gauge, like, okay, well, if I do something about that, then that means that, well, an 8's a bad example because you can't do anything about it, but like,
can't alter it, right?
Like a higher card, right? Like a 7 or something. You can say, well, like, I know I can alter that to something else, but it's going to cost me X number of sticks to do that. So that means that I have to mitigate my hand in this other way, right? Or I know that I have 4 trumps in my hand. And while those are not guaranteed to win, they are stronger cards.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, like, I found myself doing that mental math of, okay, well, I have this number of strong cards. Yes, they could still get trumped by somebody playing a stick and turning something into a 9, right? Sure, that can happen. But I liked that puzzle of trying to figure out, okay, well, I have these things. I know I can change them into these things if I need to, but I could also use them for this other purpose if things go a different direction. Yeah. And playing that, like,
it's a
like
very
that's
gut
where the
feel thing.
right? If the game was that and I had to pick a bid from the outset and say, well, this is what I think I can win.
There's no way.
It'd be terrible, right? Yeah. Because there's no way to know that.
Impossible.
But the fact that I can change my bid mid-hand based on what happens, I can like look at my hand and say, okay, well, this is the best I could probably do.
And that would leave me with two.
This is the worst I could probably do, and here's how I could mitigate that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like playing that tactically throughout the hand. That was fascinating to me, mm-hmm. and I really enjoyed that. I'm not going to say that it's predictable or that you can plan out or strategize anything from the beginning. And like the initial couple tricks are pretty unpredictable. But I do think that you can look at your hand and you can plan out. You can say, okay, well, this is what I think is the range of possibilities and the range in which I need to like be able to play with my bid. And I really enjoyed that puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So I gave this game a 5 too. I really like this one. I really want to explore it some more.
The Retreat.
Awesome. Yeah, I liked it a lot. So it surprised me because like after playing American Bookshop, which I was really excited about, I own that one. I don't own this one, unfortunately. I was really excited about that one. And it has its good points, but ultimately we kind of failed it overall. So I was surprised by this one, but I liked it.
I think the one downside really is why in the world is it called Twinkle Starship and not like right. Alarm Clock, the trick taking game?
That would be a better name.
Thematically, 0 points.
You got to get up at 6.
Yeah, every time I look at the cards, I just see those really bright red numbers that you see when you're looking at your alarm clock at like 4:30 in the morning. That's just like what it looks like. I'm like, oh, it's traumatizing.
Yeah. Well, they're interested. Where can they find it, Chris?
Ugh. This game is hard to find.
Uh-oh.
It was a Kickstarter like not that long ago.
That's how I got it. So this game delivered on Kickstarter within the year.
It's in a beautiful green magnetic box.
Yeah, it's a little magnetic box. I think, so the reason why this game is kind of rare, I think, is because this publisher is small. He self-publishes his games. I think this game will probably get picked up.
It was called something else before, though, wasn't it? I feel like it was maybe a different name.
I don't think so.
Twins Lion Doe Books.
Yeah, I think this game will get picked up and it'll become more widely available. I think the reason it's so rare is because it's just self-published by him, and if you didn't get it in the Kickstarter, it's just going to be hard to get.
Is this one of the ones that like our fans like really want us to start a publishing company for?
Right. We could make this game. So it's not old.
Cameron can make sticks.
Like, oh my gosh. 2020. All right. But there are no copies on Noble Knight. There are only 3 copies on BGG. So,
wow.
Sorry.
Slim pickings.
Yeah, it's slim pickings, but I think it'll probably get picked up by a bigger publisher. If and when Twinkle Starship gets reprinted, which I think it will.
Should, yeah.
And it should, because it's a good game. I think we all agree on that. It's just so unique. You should pick it up. If you ever have a chance to grab it, if you like Trick Takers, you need to try it.
Trick Takers is so fun.
This game is just so unusual.
I'll try any Trick Taker.
It's called Segment Tricks or 7 Segment Tricks.
What is it?
Segment Tricks.
Oh, that's what it used to be called?
Yeah. Okay. Or also called 7 Segment Tricks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I don't hate the current name so much.
I like Twinkle
Starship. Twinkle Starship. It's fun. For whatever reason it's called that, it's a fun name.
All right.
Those are our thoughts on Twinkle Starship.
Nice. Awesome. So before Cameron leads us into our outro stuff, I'll just quickly mention we're taking a little bit of a break because of New Year's and Christmas, and Jason's traveling again. So we're going to be not at full strength, and I think probably is a good time to take a breather. So I wouldn't expect another episode probably till the very end of January, maybe the first week of February, but I think end of January is probably what we're aiming for. So just giving everybody a heads up.
Fair enough.
All right.
Great. Well, of course, we want to thank everyone for joining us on this special Christmas spectacular episode of Hidden Gems. We really enjoy doing these holiday episodes with you guys. It's a fun time for us. We hope it's a fun time for you as well. And of course, if you like what we're doing here, please remember it's a huge help for us if you leave us a rating, review, or you're on your podcast platform of choice. And you can always follow us on our various social media platforms. Those simple things really make a difference for the show's exposure so that more folks can enjoy exploring games with us. You can always check out the BGG Guild if you want to interact with us or share a game that you think is a hidden gem. And if you're so inclined, please consider supporting the show over at patreon.com/hiddengemspodcast or by purchasing a Hidden Gems t-shirt or hat on our website at hiddengemsboardgamepodcast.com/store. And until next time, I'm your host, Cameron.
It's Chris.
Jason.
And this is Bill.
Thanks for listening. This episode of Hidden Gems, number 58, was recorded in Raleigh, North Carolina on December 18, 2023. Join us again next episode as we try something different when we debut our Two in a New series. This time, we'll be looking at games with a flight theme. Two games will be older, one will be new. Will the older games stand up to the new hotness? Tune in to find out. Hidden Gems is produced and edited by Chris Alley, Cameron Lockie, and Jason Nyantula. Our Board Game Geek Guild is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Ghidorah. Our Discord channel is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Snoozefest. Our show's logo was illustrated by designer and artist Caitlin Nieto. Check out her work on Instagram at @itscaitlinnieto. We would love to hear from you. Feel free to join the discussion on our many social media accounts. You can find us on Facebook at Hidden Gems Board Game Podcast, Instagram at hiddengems.podcast, and Twitter at Hidden Gems Board. Disagree with one of our reviews? Have something you want to say about one of the games we discussed today? You can also make your voice heard on our Board Game Geek Guild at BoardGameGeek.com, guild number 3874. Once again, thank you for joining us on Hidden Gems. And until next time, fellow gem seekers, enjoy your games and enjoy your search.